Anyway, it's good to leave here for
497. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. I want to note that we've put out a new agenda today, and House Bill 4097 is no longer on the agenda. And so if you're here specifically for that bill, there's no need to stay because it's not going to be heard today. We'll take the bills that we have in the order in which they're published. We'll open the, and I'm going to just describe quickly what we're going to do. We'll open the public hearing on two bills, 4066 and 4067, because they relate generally to a similar topic together. So if you're here on those two bills, be prepared to talk on one, both, or either. We'll look at House Bill, or then we'll open a public hearing after that one closes on House Bill 4076, the bill involving capital gains taxes. And then after we've finished with that one, we'll open the three bills together, House Bill 4087, 4088, and 4157, because, again, they deal generally with the same topic. So if you're here prepared to talk about any of those bills, that would be the time to be heard on that. Do we have a list? Not yet.
We have two.
He's coming. Okay. And with that, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4066 and House Bill 4067. Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4066 deals with centrally assessed property. It states that communication property for the purposes of central assessment does not include data transmission services provided through a contractual arrangement. It also sets a date of July 1, 2009 for application of the change, and then it establishes a refund process for property owners that would become exempt back to 2009 or exempt from central assessment. Just a little bit of background, as you know, the issue around what constitute communications companies has been a major issue in property taxes for the state. They are, by a current statute, anything defined as a communications company is centrally assessed by the Department of Revenue, and of course that's a very significant issue because centrally assessed property does have a different property tax base. It does include intangible property in the calculation of taxable property, and therefore can have a significant impact on tax liability. And the related bill is House Bill 4067, and what we have done is prepare the draft measure summary on the Dash 1 amendment, which we received. You recall that Representative McClain was here to talk about the original bill 4067 at your January meeting. The Dash 1 amendment makes this bill consistent with what's being considered in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And essentially what it does is clarifies that a company that is an owner of a data center is not centrally assessed if certain conditions are met. And then it goes and spells out those conditions. And the amendment does limit that exemption from central assessment to the same period as an enterprise zone agreement and limits it to property within an enterprise zone that's part of an enterprise zone agreement. So those are the two bills before you, 4066 and 4067.
Okay, now I have a representative, a member of the House who wants to speak on each of those bills. Do you two want to come up together and you can present on the two bills yourselves, and then we'll take the other testimony, if you'd prefer. You'll defer, please. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Sean Lindsay. I represent House District 30, commonly known as Silicon Forest. And smack dab in the middle of Silicon Forest is Yahoo, with an apostrophe at the end of it. And I've toured the offices. I've been there. In fact, my house was, my previous house was literally just a couple blocks away from it. So I've been there, toured it. And I can personally attest that their office is not what I consider to be something centrally assessed. There are not telephone poles running from it. There are not lots of wires running from it. Essentially laptops and desk centers. It's a call center. And it's not what fits my definition of a centrally assessed company. Now, thankfully, the Department of Revenue has passed an emergency rule that provides immediate relief, but it's temporary. It's not full-fledged, and it's helpful. I'm glad that the governor is leading on this. But let's be clear, the problem is not solved, and the legislature does need to pass a law that comprehensively addresses this issue, because frankly, it's outdated. We know that technology is clipping along pretty quickly, and we need to get something passed, if not this session, then 2013. Thankful for the committee having a hearing on this. Let's keep this conversation going so that companies like Yahoo, that's in my district, are not centrally assessed because they don't fit that description as I see it. And that's on House Bill 4066. I'd like to put my hat on and give a little comment on House Bill 4076, which is the Invest in Oregon Act. With your permission, I'll do that.
We'd have to open a hearing on that, and we're not ready to open that hearing yet.
Okay.
So you may want to come back when that hearing's open.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Lindsay? Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Appreciate that. And then we'll hear from Representative McLean.
Members of the committee, Chairs Berger and Barnhart, thank you. I'm Mike McLean. I represent in the House of Representatives District 55, which includes all of Crook County, where a data center, Facebook, is located in an enterprise zone. I invited to the table with me on my right is Judge Mike McCabe, who's our county judge, and whose signature on an enterprise zone agreement it has led to a lot of discussion. So I thought I'd show you the guy who started all of this. And on my left is Jason Carr, who is the Crook County Prineville Economic Development Director, who has worked tirelessly and done a fantastic job bringing business to the hardest hit county by this great recession, where unemployment continues to be above 15%. And if it weren't for the efforts of the two gentlemen I sit by, I'm sure it would be 25%. But today I wanted to urge you to pass House Bill 4067 as amended by the -1 amendments. Specifically, the -1 amendments incorporate the agreement that was reached between all the parties that were negotiating over how to provide certainty to data centers, and specifically how to honor enterprise zone agreements in whatever industry they attract to our hard-hit areas in the state. The -1 amendments are before you now, and if adopted by you, would mirror what the Senate has done in its revenue committee. And hopefully the wisdom of both bodies will send that to the governor's desk, and the first one there wins. I've also submitted for the record a letter of support from the Crook County School District, our mayor of Prineville, Betty Ropey, of the Central Oregon Cities Organization, and a private company, CLSG Consulting, who works with some pending data centers. And when I say pending data centers, I mean not only Facebook and its future data centers where it can locate anywhere, but as you may know, there are data centers that have come to Prineville, Boardman, Hillsboro, where Representative Lindsay and Representative Ayer have the privilege of serving, also have enterprise zones where data centers are looking. And in essence, what House Bill 4067 does, and what we're asking you to pass, is to restore certainty to enterprise zones in this area, which became uncertain because of a revenue ruling, and you've all been briefed on that, but also specifically so that Judge McCabe can go out and sign more deals with other companies in our enterprise zone in Prineville and can assure them that his signature is good, and that Oregon will take the hard tasks, roll up its sleeves, and work to get it done to make sure that our enterprise zone agreements are honored and we can continue to attract new businesses as this will do. With that, I thank you again for your time, and I specifically thank both chairs for all of their work behind the scenes and for not getting annoyed for all the times I sat in front of your office to talk to you. I'm available to answer any questions before Judge McCabe speaks.
I think maybe since you have them there, we'll hear from these two gentlemen, and then we have at least one more who's also come more than 100 miles. And
Roger Lee. We just didn't have a fourth chair, and he lives in Bend, and so you'll understand Central Oregon if we left the Bend guy in the back.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds a little bit like Eugene feels about Portland. Please.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Berger and Barnhart. Thank you. I'm honored to be here today. I was going to come testify, and then I wasn't going to come testify, and so I apologize for my dress code here today. I should have spiffed up a little bit. So here's where I'm going with this. Property taxes or any kind of taxes would help me and Crook County more than anybody else in this room. I don't want taxes, ladies and gentlemen, members of the committee. I want jobs. Our people in Crook County have stepped up. We've not had a cost of living or a merit increase for 3 years, starting into our next budget, and I'm not sure they're going to get one then. So we're wanting to do what's right for having folks like Facebook come to our community and treat them right. And they've been great, great neighbors. I can't tell you everything they've done for our community. So data centers, at least our initial blush on data centers has been very great. So as Representative McLean pointed out, we are in the process of talking to another data center that is going to hopefully sign on the dotted line as soon as this legislation is through. So time you can allow to it to put it through fairly fast, it would be great for us to get them going. So they're good neighbors. Just from a Facebook standpoint, when we first started talking to them a few years ago, they were going to use 300 gallons of water. As we're sitting here today, they're using 300 gallons of water per minute. They're using 22 gallons of water per minute. So big savings there. And again, I just can't tell you enough about how great they've been for our community. So thank you very much for all your work. Thank you to Representative McLean.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, co-chairs Berger and Barnhart. My name is Jason Carr, and I am the Economic Development Director for Prineville and Crook County. Roger, who is sitting over there, is the Executive Director of Economic Development for Central Oregon, EDCO for short, and we're the Regional Economic Development Group that serves the Tri-County area of Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook Counties. And, of course, I serve specifically Prineville and Crook County. And I wanted to talk a little bit to give some context into the economic impact of data centers. They're a new industry in Oregon, something that many of us aren't used to, and I think sometimes there's some misconceptions about, well, there's only so many jobs attached to an industry that uses up a lot of resources. I don't think I need to really spend a lot of time on what type of an economy that rural Eastern Oregon is. Crook County, obviously, has depended for many years on natural resources and agriculture. And unfortunately, with the recession, we have lost nearly 2,000 jobs since 2008 and have a 15.3% unemployment rate. So needless to say, jobs are paramount in Crook County. Facebook's data center to this point has had a remarkable impact on the economy of not only Crook County, but Oregon as well. Just recently, Eco Northwest, headquartered in Eugene with offices also in Portland, just released an economic impact study detailing the economic and fiscal impacts of Facebook. And what they did in this report is use the expenditure approach. So when Facebook began constructing the facility in 2010, They basically went back and looked at all of the dollars that have been spent on investment dollars to build the facility, along with the capital and infrastructure and then ongoing operations when the first data center building came online. Just wanted to share a couple of those numbers with you. For the state of Oregon as a whole, if you take all of the impacts from an aggregate, it's been $142 million worth of economic activity, 51.4 in personal income, and over 1,000 jobs created in Oregon. Obviously, a lot of those temporary construction jobs, but much-needed jobs nonetheless. In Crook County, they looked at two different areas, both the construction period and then the ongoing operation. So what happens? What's the impact once the construction jobs go away? And for the construction aspect, it's $15.2 million in economic activity, specifically to Crook County, $6 million in personal income, as well as 148 jobs for the local workers during the construction period. I think before I talk about the operations, it's important to note that Facebook is currently now started construction on its second building. And so you can extrapolate out, and they'll be using the same amount of construction workers, same amount of activity on that second building as with the first. In terms of the operations, there's 57 full-time employees at the facility today. And over the last year, that facility is responsible for over $21 million in economic activity, $5.5 million in personal income, and 111 jobs. And, of course, when you take the 57 full-time jobs and then the 111, there's economic multipliers out there. So basically it's a 2-to-1 ratio of jobs that when Facebook creates two jobs, there's another job, ancillary job that's created to serve the facility elsewhere. These wages, too, are 35% above what the average is across all industries in Central Oregon. And with wages and benefits, the average compensation at Facebook is $59,400. And again, this is a report that was published by Eco Northwest, which I could be happy to submit into the record or that you could access and look at the numbers yourself. And just a couple other things I want to mention as I go along here is Judge McCabe talked about the partnership with Facebook in the community. They just recently released about $110,000 worth of charitable donations to our local schools, nonprofit, and public service agencies. They've been able to help the school district purchase smart boards, calculators, other needed materials for the school district that they wouldn't have without some of these donations. And the other interesting thing about these impacts is this is what is considered net new infusion of investment in Oregon. All of the investment dollars to build this facility came from outside of Oregon. So the circulation of dollars is much greater because it's all outside money coming in, nothing that originated here in Oregon. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of context as to what the economic impact has been, and not only in construction but ongoing. When you talk about $5.5 million of personal income and 111 jobs of a county right now that has about 7,000 in the workforce, it's a pretty significant impact for us in this recession. So thank you for your time this afternoon. Thank you for working with Representative McLean and for your work on this bill. And I would ask that you would support House Bill 4067. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so the record is somewhat clear, since I'm from the eastern part of the state, my vision of this whole situation has been kind of like we have all these highly volatile taxpayers corralled, and we're about to open a gate. We're going to let Facebook through it, and we want to be careful that the rest of those volatile groups don't follow them. So the key here has been to make sure in this exercise, in this discussion, that by this carve-out, we don't inadvertently release the entire herd. That's the key. And I'm just wondering, President McLean, if I think you and I have discussed this now several times, if your view of this is similar. This exercise that we're engaged in today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, my view would be that there was part of the herd that was already in the corral, and all we're doing is restoring the feed. We're not necessarily letting them out, and meaning that there was an agreement that needed to be honored. And what we're doing today is honoring that agreement with data centers that are in enterprise zones, because data centers are the industry that endured the uncertainty produced by the erratic behavior of the Department of Revenue. Now, and I understand that 2013 would be a session that invites a more holistic view of what are intangibles in the central assessment statute, and I understand many members of your committee are eager to roll up their sleeves and do that. However, I don't think I would call this a carve-out in the sense of Facebook is getting a carve-out, because the beneficiary of this is the locales that have enterprise zones, and that specifically Facebook and other companies, which there I know of five others, that are data centers that want to locate in enterprise zones, want to know that the agreements that they sign are not going to be negated by the Department of Revenue. It may be semantic, but I don't consider that a carve-out as restorative.
Thank you. No follow-up.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Thank you both for coming the long road over to in the rain, which is something you get a lot less of over there, to talk with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
The other two who came from, who have indicated they came from more than 100 miles away, Corey Owens and Roger Lee, the much aligned band.
For the record, thank you very much for taking testimony. Roger Lee, I'm the Executive Director of EDCO, Economic Development for Central Oregon. Co-chairs Berger and Bernhardt, thanks again for making this part of your agenda in this short session. I'm not going to talk so much about the impacts. I think that's been well covered. What I would like to talk about is just how this information really impacts business decisions in Oregon. And I would say that we have a number of different projects looking at Oregon right now, not just in our region, but across the state, that are really waiting to see what happens with this bill, with this legislation, and whether they make a decision. And the reason being is that we're competing, obviously, with a lot of other states in the nation, but specifically a few in the Midwest and a few in the East Coast, and then our state to the north. And we compete on those on a basis of combination of utilities, including power, which is obviously very important. So it's a combination of power rates and then tax policy. So if you've got a tax policy like we have in Oregon that really rewards large investments, like with the enterprise zone, it helps mitigate relatively higher power costs compared to a place like Central Washington. If for some reason you then take away that tax policy or it calls it into a question, and I think there's good precedent out there as far as what central assessment and the taxation of intangibles can do to a utility, in this case, we'd probably disagree that if most of these data centers are even utilities to begin with, it really changes the perspective of them making decisions. So I think what hangs in the balance today on 4067 is probably about $1.5 billion of capital investment into the state, and really hundreds of permanent jobs, up to thousands of temporary jobs in construction. That's a huge impact for our small state, and I can tell you it's a huge impact for a region like ours in Central Oregon that, in the case of Prineville, has been the hardest hit from this recession in terms of unemployment, job loss, et cetera. It is a bright spot, and I think we have an example of what could happen in that area, and what could happen for some other rural communities in the state. If you look at Quincy, Washington, for example, 6 years ago they had the highest unemployment rate, or one of the, among the highest in Washington. That unemployment rate is now half of what it used to be. They have over 500 high-technology jobs in that community, all from data center development and then some of the ancillary things that have come along. And that's kind of our vision for what could happen in the Central Oregon area, but it could happen other places in the state as well. It's an industry that has really it is very hot right now and is expected to continue to be so for the next decade. If our tax policy in this state rewards communities and sets it up to win in this industry, I think Oregon will benefit long term. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Corey Owens, and I represent at least some of the cattle in the corral. I also represent at least one of the parties to the prenuptial agreement. I greatly appreciate, Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, the extensive time and energy that you've put into this issue. A lot has been said about people by people who are smarter than I, so I'll be very brief. Facebook has entered Oregon and built there our flagship facility. In terms of our infrastructure, this is our home. It was the very first piece of property we ever owned as a company. We like to think that our brightest days are in front of us, and we would very much like for the partnership with Oregon to be a part of that future. We believe that the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4067 represents the results of careful negotiations over several months with members of this committee, a number of the folks who have testified, the governor's office. And we believe that the amendment in front of you will accomplish the goal of producing some certainty for data center operators, and specifically in a manner that will encourage further development around the state, not just in Crook County. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? We've stretched the metaphor about as far as it goes.
Mr. Co-Chair, can we add urban chicken coops to that? They're actually not as far apart as we think.
No, please, no.
And they're allowed in your district, are they?
Hawaiian chickens fly in the coop.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Nicholas Chang, Greg Chamoff. Gentlemen.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Nicholas Chan, and I'm the senior director here in Hillsborough, I actually had the pleasure of coming out here and opening up the office back in 2005. Just kind of give you some background into where we came from and how the office came about out here. In 2005, we came out here with primarily two groups.
And for those people who are watching us on the Internet, you might identify the company that you work for. Oh. I think the rest of us know.
Sorry about that. I'm actually with Yahoo.
Thank you.
All right. And so basically, we came out here in 2005, two groups, primarily customer service and a small business sales group, roughly about 100 people. You fast forward to today, we have approximately about 352 people employed here, and we have groups from customer service to mid-market sales to premier account management and media coordinators. So we have grown our operations significantly within Hillsborough. As far as the growth that we've had out here, I'm very proud. Just based on the work that we've done, the people that we've hired really represent the area that we are in. To give you some contrast, and Representative Lindsay actually did a pretty good job kind of explaining our office, but Yahoo is obviously an informational site that's accessed to the World Wide Web. When you go in our office, like he said, it's desktop computers, laptop computers, telephones, things of that nature. When I came out and actually did the facility build out, we didn't require any type of infrastructure, any type of lines or anything like that, telephone poles being built or brought in. That's what we kind of subcontract out. So basically, 2009 rolled around. And and I'm no expert in taxes, and I'll let Mr. Chamoff kind of take that on. But 2009 rolled around, I saw our taxes go from about $130,000 to about $500,000. That singular action basically put us at a disadvantage. And what I mean by that is recently, we had a couple groups down in Sunnyvale, and we had a new group actually that was formed. These particular job sets and the particular type of people that they're looking for would have fit very well within our community, the type of people that we hire within Hillsborough. Unfortunately, the decision was made without any consideration to Hillsborough to move those to Nebraska. Obviously, I was very disappointed in that particular piece. We have approximately seating capacity for 300 more people. But yet we still continue to, you know, to look for other spaces and put people in other offices. You know, unfortunately, the application of the central tax has put us at a little bit of a disadvantage. You know, obviously the cost of sales, things of that nature, but not only for our office, but for companies basically in our area, in our space. You know, more importantly, it's possibly put Oregon at a disadvantage, you know, working and bringing new business in, you know, like they call it the Silicon Forest. I know I've worked with the Greater Greenlight of Portland, talking to different companies, bringing them in and trying to talk to them about bringing their offices here, some of them which were that were in the internet space, were in our space that would possibly fall into the central tax bracket. Over the past year, we've spoken to legislators, governor's office, and you know, earlier this week we got the ruling from the governor's office that recognizes our concerns, and we're very appreciative of the understanding and importance of this issue. It's not, you know, not companies such as Yahoo, but any company that wishes you know, that wishes to set up an online presence here in Oregon. You know, the ruling is a step in the right direction. We obviously feel very strongly about that, and we look forward to building on a, you know, good working relationship that's been started by the governor's office to you know, really work together and bringing more jobs to Oregon. You know, and again, thanks for hearing my testimony coming in here. You know, I want to come and kind of you know, explain where we came from. You know, my personal investment into Hillsborough, and trying to grow this building out. So with that, I'll turn it over to Greg. To
thank you.
Mr. Chamoff, welcome back. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Mr. and Madam Co-Chairs, members, Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright to Maine, today representing Yahoo. Want to thank first Representative Lindsay for his concise presentation today, presenting the problem for you that we're here to ask you to solve. Because we seem to have run out the line on Representative Bence's herd analogy, let me leave you with a couple of others to help highlight the pickle that we're in. I've left you some written testimony, which I commend to your reading and whatever leisure you have in this turbo session. But if you take a couple of ideas away from your consideration of this measure, I hope it's this. First, there are some kinds of companies that are to the tax system in Oregon like the blind men and the elephant. Very large companies that are utility companies, railroads, telephone companies, that sort of thing. They will have a tail in Clatsop County, a foot in Marion, Lane, Yam Hill, Clackamas County, perhaps a body in Multnomah, ears in Umatilla, and a trunk that stretches all the way to Malheur County. And no one county tax assessor can make a fair assessment of what that entity is, can't describe that elephant for purposes of taxing it. To solve that problem, this body many years ago created the concept of central assessment. Through that process, the state looks at the entire elephant and decides how much the elephant is valued at and then divvies that up for the various counties. Works really well when you have in your sights an elephant. Yahoo is not an elephant. Yahoo is a single sales building in a single county and should not have been centrally assessed at all. Representative McLean was careful to point out that these are not cut-out bills. These are not carve-out bills intended to take a company that has traditionally been part of a particular tax scheme and to give it some benefit. This particular effort is to assist companies that suddenly, with no change in their business practices, found themselves with substantially higher tax bills. Which brings us to the second analogy, which is the spot-changing leopard. Those of you who survived Sunday school will recall that leopards are not supposed to change their spots. The problem that we've had here is that this body last changed the communication statutes when I was in junior high. In 2009, however, the Department of Revenue adopted a rule that purported to cover Yahoo and have its sales facility taxed as if it were a communications company, even though in Oregon, Yahoo does not transmit electrons from one place to another, and in the United States, Yahoo does not transmit electrons from one place to the other. In 2010, the Court of Appeals, on a challenge to the rule, invalidated the rule, telling the department that the department had not undertaken the, quote, informed rulemaking, close quote, that this body had instructed the department to undertake. The department's response was, we don't need a rule. We can do it without a rule. Through the good auspices of the governor's office, we now have a rule that uncovers Yahoo. And we're quite appreciative of the effort of the governor's office and the recent flexibility shown by the Department of Revenue under the department under the governor's guidance. But in the span of 3 years, we've gone from a rule that covered Yahoo to no rule to a rule that doesn't cover Yahoo. And as Representative Lindsay pointed out, one of the most important aspects to any business that will invest in this state is certainty. Having the kind of changes that have occurred over the past few years is not the kind of change that is conducive to having a business climate that you folks want on our behalf. To achieve the kind of certainty that's necessary, you can pass this bill as is. It has the particular advantage to ending the litigation that those of us are involved in the tax court. The governor's rule takes care of the problem for the tax years beginning July 1, 2012, but there are still past tax years, past tax bills that are hanging over companies that we will continue to litigate until this body takes a definitive action to solve the problem. This body could also adopt the governor's rule into statute, and if that were made retroactive, would be a particularly simple and elegant solution. And either of those we commend to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Ayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit probably more of a comment. Your paper and just kind of briefing through it. Thank you. Written only like a lawyer can. But it.
God bless you.
When perhaps the one case where Shakespeare's thing shouldn't hold true, except for in the case of Representative Wand. But
and Representative Wand is out of order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you too. Are you an attorney? Thank you, coming to the rescue of a thing. So what this strikes me as central assessment, gut check, not a technical check, but a gut check, a central assessment is where we have some functionality of a business that is not central. It's broadened throughout the state. And it has physical property, which property tax is trying to get at physical property throughout the state. But in recognizing that in the functionality of that company, that the whole of the of whatever they've done, like railroad tracks, the whole is worth more than the sum of its parts. And that's where we get to the intangible aspect in central assessment. So it requires specifically that they're not allowed to, or not, it's what it requires is that these parts are throughout more than one county. If they were all contained in one county, there wouldn't need to be a central assessment. So in Yahoo's case, for example, are you in one county?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Beyer, yes.
Thank you. And then I find this slightly humorous. Is this true in reading the one of the reasons that the department said throughout the extrapolation of this legal suit that's ongoing that the one of the reasons why you're a communication company is because you provide email addresses to customers who want them?
Mr. and Madam Co-Chair, Representative Ayer, yes. I believe, although I have not had a discussion with the representatives of the department about that, that the department may ascribe some significance to that act, that isn't warranted by the circumstances. Providing an email address is essentially the electronic equivalent of selling stationery. We'll be happy to let you put your monograms on a nice envelope and use it, but that doesn't make Yahoo a company that then transmits back and forth. You'd have to go to an actual communication company to get that service.
So then if we had, and perhaps I shouldn't ask this question, but I'm going to, then if we had another company that provides email addresses that has no physical property within the state of Oregon, but still provides these email addresses, a competitor of yours, for example, does that then provide nexus to the state of Oregon by the mere fact that they offer email addresses and provide them to Oregon residents?
Mr. and Madam Co-Chair, Representative Ayer, given that I represent that competitor in the tax court on these very issues, my answer is, of course not.
Spoken like a good lawyer.
And thank you. And I say that because the mere fact of, for me, again, gut check, the mere fact that a company that does not have any physical nexus provides an email address does not in and of itself create nexus, that this should then be a consequential, the providing of email addresses is actually consequential to the actual place here and should not be a driver of connecting to central assessment. And maybe nobody understands what I just said because it just came out of my brain, but that seems to me that that is really more consequential, not a driver of establishing something subject to a company subject to central assessment.
Mr. and Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Ayer, I can only hope the tax judge is that astute. Yes.
Or was that a compliment? I wasn't
yes.
sure.
thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Representative Juan, did you want to comment? No.
I'm good, thank you.
He passes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you very much for your time. Today and for your testimony. I want to note for the record that we have received a number of documents, some of which have been presented by those who have testified, and of course those will go in the record on the respective bill files. We've received two from persons who I don't expect to hear from because they're not on my list. One is from the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council that supports House Bill 4067, signed by John Mullis, and one from TechNet supporting House Bill 4066, signed by Jim Hawley. So we'll simply note those for the record, and we'll call our next panel. It turns out we have three additional people who would like to speak on 4066, and at least a couple of them would also like to speak on 4067. When I call them, I don't expect that anyone will assume that they're of the same opinion about things necessarily. Chuck Sheketoff, Barb Young, and Mike Dewey.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barnhart and Berger and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Sheketoff of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We're neutral on this bill, and we understand it's trying to address the issue of central assessment with today's technology, but I wanted to raise a couple points with you. First, I would encourage you to be careful so that any carve-out you're doing now or as you continue to look at central assessment, you don't create a situation where in 5 or 10 years you realize you did let an elephant out of the zoo, to use the prior analogy, that the technology changes and you should be talking, I think, with get your own counsel on the communications world about how to write these so that they are limited down the future. Second, I would note that, you know, Google, I think, is an interesting example because I have a Google Voice phone number. It's a phone number that's published, looks like any ordinary phone number. I get my voicemail on it. I actually, to use the example earlier, I actually do have to contact Google to receive my voicemail. It's no different than a Verizon or Frontier or whatever. And so whether or not they're not a communications company, I think, is somewhat questionable about that. Second and last, I would just say that I know you're trying to work with great vigor at addressing this issue, which is going to save Facebook and some other companies significant dollars. I would only ask that you also assign the same vigor to looking at whether these very profitable companies ought to be paying corporate income taxes on their profits. Changes in the law, when this committee first started debating single sales factor, Facebook wasn't even born. And they're now probably paying only $150 a year. They're an LLC owned by the corporation, and their operation here, and they're probably only because that building doesn't make sales. As you've noted, it's just a place where data goes in and data goes out. And you know, they're relying on state resources. They like the fact that they're getting an educated workforce in the Prineville area. I believe they ought to be paying corporate income taxes to support the state resources, which make Oregon, Prineville, and Crook County a great place to operate and do business and stay.
Thank you. And is that your remarks on both bills?
Yes.
Thank you. Please.
Representative Berger, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Barb Young. I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink in Oregon. Just briefly on House Bill 4067, CenturyLink is cautiously neutral on that. I guess I'll phrase it that way with the Dash 1 amendment. It is a very, very narrow exemption, particularly with the recent addition of limiting the time for the exemption as tied to actually the tax abatement period. We are opposed to House Bill 4066. It's much too broad of an exemption from our perspective. We have some concern with changing the definition of a communications company without further analysis and discussion, particularly given how quickly the technology is merging. And I think the example of Google Voice is very, very telling. We didn't have Google Voice 2 years ago. And from my perspective and my company's perspective, it sure looks, smells, and tastes like a communications company. So we look forward to perhaps some interim discussion. You know, our issue is really the lack of parity with regard to tax treatment for CenturyLink with and its competitors. So, and particularly with regard to the intangible piece of the central assessment. So we're hoping we can have some meaningful discussion during the interim to try to tackle that truly elephant in the room. I don't know that I like the other reference, but I'll let that go. So with that, I appreciate having the opportunity to make comments and be happy to answer any questions you have. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, members, Mike Dewey representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. The cable industry has approximately 2,700 employees in the state. The cable industry is centrally assessed. We litigated the rule that Mr. Chamoff spoke to, which was invalidated. And I find it somewhat interesting that the in the Comcast case, which Comcast prevailed at the tax court, the Department of Justice said we didn't need a rule because the statute was clear on its face. And now we have a rule that addresses some of the technologies, obviously not the cable industry. Mr. Chamoff in 1973 was in junior high. I was in the Senate hearing and in the House hearing in 1973, unfortunately. And I had no idea that we would be doing this in the 1980s, and now here we are again, starting in 2009. Obviously, we're here because when we get to, we have no problem with centrally assessing cable companies in the sense that we want to make clear that the Department of Revenue does the assessment. We do have issues when you define us as a communication company and you take into consideration intangibles, and Facebook has illustrated this magnificently in the sense that they understand when the IPO hits the street that the value on the intangible side will be significant. And cable bills have gone up. Comcast bill went up 4 times. We also pay franchise fees and other fees to cities, so it's not as though we're not contributing. We are now at the Supreme Court. We're still waiting for a schedule. And hopefully we'll have some illumination from the Supreme Court prior to 2013. Have no clue whether or not that's going to take place. And I think the tax court judge is waiting as there are other cases lined up, not only cable companies, Yahoo, I understand Microsoft is in cable companies. We had talked to some of you about the concerns initially we had with 4067. Those concerns, and we've worked with Mr. Owens and the others, and we they've been very gracious to work with, and we appreciate that. And so we're cautiously neutral on that bill. We understand a deal was a deal. I told our clients that they asked, well, what was the situation with Google or Facebook? And I said, they're in an enterprise zone. There's an agreement to have a tax abatement, and that was a local decision. So I was as surprised by anybody else that they were going to be centrally assessed, but obviously there was an omission in the statute. So they were centrally assessed, and we have a bill that is narrowly crafted to deal with data centers, and I think that's appropriate. We do have a concern, though, with 4066, because, quite frankly, I don't know what the language means. I'm concerned about the predominant use and exempting a company who could later become a communication company, and that portion of their property, which is essential to their operation, would be exempt. And other companies that have similar facilities, I understand they're a call center or a help center. We have those. Those are part of our business, and those are centrally assessed today. So there are some concerns about the language. I don't know if it can be fixed in this particular bill. We believe we have to have as many people in the room from the industry to talk about how to fix the 73 statute. Because the interpretations aren't working today for competitors that are in the business with different technologies. The gentleman on my right talked about Google Voice. We're in the voice business. We're in the video business. And there's Google TV. There's Apple TV. And if we're all treated differently, we pick winners and losers. And we've got to figure out a way to find some neutrality in terms of technology. So we're okay with 4067. We do not like 4066. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As this discussion proceeds, it becomes clear from a lot of the testimony, and some of those testifying have commented that it's clear that this is an issue that we are going to have to take up in the interim. And suffer a significant amount of brain damage on, and looking forward to that, really. But as we head into that work group, I'm just curious to help scope some of the discussion. What, Mr. Dewey or Ms. Young, what are some of the characteristics of a company that should be centrally assessed, and how does Comcast look at that?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, again, we have to really start with, I think, what other states do in this area and how they treat these facilities or services. Again, most, to my knowledge, on the cable side, I don't believe there are any states that centrally assess the intangibles of cable companies. Telephone companies were different back then. And in many cases, we were doing the central assessment were utilities, and they had literally no competition. And the company that she works for has had a few iterations before she came along, and they were a natural monopoly. And Judge Green broke that monopoly up, and over time, we were able to get into the business. The technology changed, and they have an issue here, but. We can't start with looking at the intangible side of the business, the whole unit, because, one, it's too complex. We're going to be in tax court often, and we want to avoid that. So it might be that you get very clear as to who's in and who's out, but if we don't have a good methodology, and I think eventually there's going to have to be some sort of surrogate or proxy to an intangible because of the amount of money it's included in this debate. But we have to have a policy first, but we can't start with, well, we want to figure out who's and who. If we start with we're going to tax intangibles, we've got to, I think we, you also, would have a problem getting some clarity down the road. I don't know if I answered that at all.
Well,
yeah, please, go ahead.
At the risk of getting too off track here, and I apologize to the listening public at home for having to sort through the phrase proxy to an intangible. But I'm curious, so if a company is contracting for transmission services, for example, but doesn't actually provide transmission services, how does that fall into your definition?
Co-chairs, Representative Bailey, I mean, I don't even know if I want to get there at this point in time, because I think you just start all over. And I don't even think you start to look at, okay, what are the services provided? And, okay, what are the technologies? And you figure out everybody who's going to be in this box providing these services is either going to be in something or out of something. They're going to pay property taxes. And if they're complicated properties, they ought to be assessed by the Department of Revenue. And I think you start there. And then you get into, okay, on what basis, what's the theory behind or the methodology for getting at their value? And usually it's cost less depreciation. I mean, that's very easy, and you're not going to have too many arguments. I think you have to start there. Unfortunately, there are some other players that would have a different view of how you can raise money that have to be in the room also. But I think it's difficult, and that's why I believe the governor's office will take a very serious interest in this, because I know they want to solve it from the Economic Development Department. You know, our issue is, quite frankly, we're not going away. We're going to continue to make investments because we don't have any choice, because everybody's getting into everybody else's business. And so we have the conundrum of the properties that are here and making sure they can survive, because the tax bill is immense that Comcast got. And then it's going to be difficult for Comcast if they prevail in the Supreme Court, because there's a bunch of money owed to Comcast. And we know what the headlines are going to look like, unfortunately. And then there are companies that would like to come here, and they need certainty. And we've got to fix both those.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Vance.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Bailey's questions, because he's exactly where I think we're going to be. Perhaps you could, any one of the three of you, express for us, and I should have asked Mr. Chamoff this question, if the 100-year-old definition, which was based upon the integration over wide areas, and the railroad is an entire thing, it has to be assessed as a whole, if that's the proper foundation for what we're about next. Because, as has been pointed out, Yahoo is not spread over a wide area physically, at least as we used to define it. So where should we start with this exercise? With the old 100-year-old definition, or should we start with, gee, if it's intangible and has to be assessed as a whole, then we're going to subject you to central assessment? Tell us where to start.
I would say you start with I think the reason you looked at whether it's throughout the state is whether it's difficult for a county to come up with an appropriate assessment because of the multiple locations. So I think, you know, a Yahoo one site, if there's a call center, I don't think a Yahoo call center is any different than, you know, some other company that sells a product, best, you know, whatever, vacuum cleaner company or whatever, it's a call center. But I think if there's multiple properties and it's involved in communications, I mean, that might be the other thing I think you need to look at is what type of communications we have. You know, we're well past the days when he served and carbon paper was the technology, right, for multiple copies. And Xerox was just getting going. So, you know, you need to look at what's the tech, how difficult is it going to be to fairly assess the company and the value of that company's property here. And should a county, I mean, I'm frankly, you know, probably the people in Crook County, my guess is, from what I've read, didn't even think about central assessment sort of on this, you know. And so at least in the early stages, and, you know, I just think you need to figure out what's the way to do it.
Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. I think from CenturyLink's perspective, You know, I haven't had a lot of in-depth discussions with our tax folks on this with regard to what would we like to see going forward. I know on the West Coast, Oregon and Colorado are the only two states that tax intangibles today. So it's not so much for us the central assessment mechanics, if you will. It's the intangible piece of it that we believe needs reform. So, you know, does that mean that you take a look at eliminating the intangibles? Okay, then what do you replace it with if you don't have that, given the caps on property tax? I think in some other states we've had the flexibility of ratcheting down the tax on intangibles, but then putting some component of an increase maybe to the property tax piece of it to kind of even things out. You know, our issue, again, is the lack of parity. If my company gets taxed on intangibles and my competitor doesn't and is therefore able to provide a more attractive pricing to its customers, then we have discriminatory practices in the marketplace just due to taxation. So that's kind of where CenturyLink's at.
Thank you.
Yes.
Well,
please, go ahead.
No, I spent enough time up here.
All right. I won't respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You present a very compelling case of the complexity of trying to solve this. So, Mr. Dewey, you said when this came around, the current law came around in the 1970s. Can you explain to me just take us through a bullet point of how the industry, your industry, has changed since then, because I'm concerned that when we go about trying to fix it and look at best practices of other states, intangible replacements, what does that look like, that our language will be outdated before we solve it. So, because it seems to be faster, can you give us a real quick how your industry has changed and evolved since the 74 language?
Thank you. So I want to thank Cable Labs for your question, because they've been the success story from, obviously, we started out in the video business, and I won't get into all the nuances of how you grow and what happened at the FCC and Congress and all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, we were able to capture a whole bunch of signals, and HBO came along first in the satellite industry and kind of reinvented the video side. And over time, there was a product called TCI had At Home. And that was really the kind of the first residential internet service. And the irony is that it went bankrupt. It was a separate entity, but it went bankrupt. But who would think that the first internet company, residential, would go bankrupt? But they had a cost model that didn't work very well. So over time, as we went from, you took the coaxial cable, now in fiber, but you were able to just literally with digitizing the signals, you were able to put so much more information into the pipe. And so you've got now, you can put voice into the pipe, you can put data into the pipe, and you can put video into the pipe. Video takes up the most. I mean, the voice and data are really small, but video takes up a huge component of it. And so we're in a situation where, you know, over time, because of technology, we were able to provide an array of services. So for Comcast and some others, they do centrally assess their telephone business, because clearly telephone was, it's in the statute, it says telephone, and say voice, but telephone. So they're centrally assessed there. But, you know, we're going to evolve over time, or they are, and all companies have to continue to make those investments. I just, you know, I'm just amazed because, you know, Facebook, I think, is 8 years old, and they're in a 15-year enterprise zone. So we're not even going to know what it looks like. But I do know that as we evolve, I mean, we're now competing with all these companies in one way or the other. And they're all going to, they have to evolve in order to stay in business. Otherwise, because of the technology and wireless is such a major player now, if you don't make the investments, you're not going to last very long. Hopefully that helps.
Thank gentlemen and lady, thank you very much for your testimony today. J.L. Wilson and Chris Fick.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. All the implications of tax certainty and what it means for investment and job growth and otherwise depressed areas has been covered. We support House Bill 4067. We believe it's a critical policy as amended. We have no position on 4066.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, other members of the committee. I'm Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. The League is similarly concerned about House Bill 4066 because of the broad scope that was articulated in the panel before, so I won't belabor the point. We are supportive of 4067. We think that this bill clarifies an important piece of statute that would enable cities throughout the state to explore some important economic development opportunities. However, unlike other members of this committee, we are not all that excited about taking a deeper look at central assessment. Municipal governments, as you all know, are heavily reliant on property tax revenues. While we are working with the Department of Revenue to determine precisely how much of our property tax revenue is derived from centrally assessed property, we have reason to believe it is a significant chunk. Any sudden change or broad opening up of what that would entail, what centrally assessed property would entail, could obviously have some pretty dire ramifications for both cities, counties, and school districts throughout the state. We encourage this committee, as you guys do, take a closer look to keep that in mind because we do think that any sudden change would have a significant impact and like the state, our cities are struggling to make our budgets balance. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I think the committee would be very interested in the results of your study.
As would we. Hopefully we get some help from DOR.
thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I have one more panel, Pat Story and company. Are there others who would like to be heard on these two bills today? The only thing I would caution the company is you need to block in such a way that when you speak, you're speaking into the microphone. Please go ahead.
On behalf of the 1%.
And would you please identify yourself?
I'm here today as Phil T. Rich. Otherwise, my name is Patrick Story, and I'd like to speak to 4067 and 4076.
Well, except that right now, the only one that's open is 4067.
Yes, I understand. These bills that let us in the 1% keep our money are wonderful. And we want to thank you for taking action on our behalf. It's just what the 1% needs. I'll be able to keep a driver on staff for another shift each day. And there's some job creation right there. Now, about Facebook, my home is on Northwest Ariel Terrace in Portland. According to the tax assessor, it has a market value of a bit over $2 million and an assessed value of about $1.3 million. My property tax for 2011 is just short of $30,000. If I could pay at Facebook's rate, my taxes would be $1,387 instead of $29,686. I'll hope to get a chance to comment on Mr. Wan's bill later.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair and Committee, my name is Ms. Spent, and my alter ego is Leah Spencer. I'm here as a private citizen on my own time, and I'm neutral on the bill, but I'm a 1% wannabe. And I think we can improve the environment in this state if we just stop wasting money in government. we really don't need that much money in public education. People have an option of sending their kids to private school. We don't need a public safety. I mean, crime is going down, and people could always live in a gated community and have private security. I mean, that's always an option. And we certainly don't need human services. There's plenty of a safety net, and that's what churches and nonprofits are for. You know, the press goes on and on about our dropout rate, but we need dropouts. If you think about it, when I order pizza, the Domino's guy just needs to know how to read and write and make change. He really doesn't need to have a college degree or have any background in algebra or trigonometry for that. We can't get along without some high school dropouts, you know, for entry-level jobs, and helps to keep wages down and gives us a good pool of folks to hire from when we have some entry-level jobs. You know, we're talking about our priorities here. We'll all be fine. There won't be any dire consequences. This is great for the 1% and the 1% wannabes, and that's where our priorities should be. And I'll just end by saying that there's another bill in another committee at 3 o'clock today in the business committee, and that I think it would be good for citizens like myself. I'm in the middle of remodeling a project on my house, and my son is my contractor. And I overheard a lobbyist in the hallway say that if you hold off on the rest of the work until the bill passes, then someone could write off half of the cost of the work to the taxpayers. So I hope you'll keep your eyes and ears open for that bill.
So the Prineville situation... the bill about that gives us a situation where the people there in Prineville...
Jody, we all know who you are,
but
would you identify yourself anyway?
I'm a rich gal. I'm a rich gal, and my name, some of you know me by, is Jody Wiser. So that land over there, you know, it was sitting there collecting $26,000 before that Facebook company came along, and it's still that city is still getting that money. And the company is being real generous. They're not paying about $350,000 in taxes they might otherwise pay each year, but they're giving away $110,000 in donations. So, yeah, I think you should think well of that company, because they're doing good, and they're choosing good things to give money to. Now, the people might think they wish the city was deciding and the school district was deciding what to do with those 5 or 10 jobs that they aren't paying taxes on, because they might want cops or teachers instead, but it's a good company. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony today. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4066 and House Bill 4067, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4076. And is that yours?
That's Chris.
Chris. Oh, Juan's going to present. Yes, right. And Representative Juan, we'll hear from Chris, and then you'll be up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 46 reduces the capital gains tax rate to 2.5% for qualified investments made on...
4076?
Yeah. Reduces the capital gains tax rate to 2.5% for qualified investment made on or after January 1, 2012, and before January 1, 2014, so for 2012 or 2013. And it applies to both personal and corporate taxes, and it requires that the investments must be made in an Oregon business or in real property located in Oregon and be held for at least 3 years, and it excludes investments in publicly traded corporations. And in your paperwork, you have a draft SMS and a draft revenue impact.
Great, thank you. Representative.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and fellow colleagues. My name is Matthew Wand. I'm a state representative from East Multnomah County, Troutdale. You know, I remember Aristotle in the rhetoric classes that I took at the community college where I started my formal education. And you have to start with credibility. I grew up in one of the 99%. My first job was at the age of 9. There was a couple across the street, a same-sex couple, who paid me by the hour to pull weeds. I worked 2 hours a day, and when I came home, my fingers would be filthy and cracked and scratched. Fast-forwarding, I always wanted in that time to have the opportunity to own my own business. And the reason is because I had seen what happened with my grandfather, who was a farmer, and the joy that he had being around his family, raising them because he owned a business. I worked hard to educate myself, putting myself through college, paying my own way, working every step of the way. And I am proud to support and to bring forward to you HB 4076. And the reason is quite simple. When I was working and trying to advance on the socioeconomic scale, so to speak, what I understood is that I couldn't do it all on my own. It required something called capital. Now, I learned from my father that there are two different types of capital, at least two. One is the type that is in money. That's capital. But the kind of capital that I had growing up was sweat capital. And that's what I put into the efforts into educating myself, and that's what I put into the efforts of my small business. And now that I have my own small business in Gresham, I understand that I am responsible for 5 different families, myself, my partners, and my 2 employees. Now, I am far from the 1%, and I certainly don't live like Filth T. Rich over there off of my $2 million home, or like Ms. Weiser off of her investments on the stock market. But at the end of the day, when I, in my small business, am trying to decide whether or not I can hire another employee and give somebody else the opportunity to have a stable life, it's capital that is holding me back. When I look around at the small businesses that I advise as their attorney, it is capital that is holding them back. When I talk with people that have access to capital, that already have wealth, the one percenters, they keep waiting on the sidelines, wondering if the economy will turn around. And while they're waiting on the sidelines, they're investing on the stock market. They're investing in gold. They're investing in the types of things that don't help my neighbors get a job. And part of the reason is that we haven't provided that one little push to get them off the sidelines and into the game here in Oregon. HB 4076 does that. It's bread on the water. I'm trying to attract ducks. I am trying to change human behavior for the folks that have capital to invest. But it is not giving away the farm. It is an opportunity to have a limited duration to spur investment now when we really need it the most for a 2-year period. But I didn't want to give away the farm or risk our delicate budget situation. And so nor do I want to encourage flipping houses or other risky investments. And so there's a minimum hold period of 3 years. That also ensures that the revenue impact is pushed out until the 15-17 biennium. There is no revenue impact in this biennium to this bill. We know from revenue it will create 1,000 jobs in 5 years. We know that it will have a revenue impact beginning in 2015 of $15 million over 5 years. What is not calculated in revenue is the effect of 1,000 people who will no longer be asking for public assistance. So I ran those numbers too. Now, granted, these are over-inclusive numbers because we don't know that all 1,000 people are currently on TANF. We don't know what their individual situations are. But what I discovered is that for every person that is on public assistance, on average, it costs the state between $2,870 a year and $5,565 a year. So by the time you back those numbers out, as making certain assumptions, we could conceivably beat down the number of $15 million over 5 years, which, again, doesn't come up in this biennium or the next biennium. This is a good bill. This is a bill that is intended to target a particular problem that we have now with access to capital. I hope that you will give it due consideration, schedule it for a work session, and move it to the floor.
Thank you. Yes, sir. You're back.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you letting me come back. My name is Sean Lindsay. I represent House District 30 in Silicon Forest. And actually, just really quickly, I'm about the same age as Representative Wand here. He and I went to law school about the same time, and I can attest to you that I've spent a lot of time with him and heard his stories of working his tail off, providing for our family, and there's a lot of sweat equity in his success. And so I congratulate him on his success, and hopefully we can continue to help him. There are two types, well, there are a lot of types, but two particular types of investment. There's investment income taxes and there's ordinary income taxes. Investment income taxes are lower than ordinary income taxes. Why? Because we want to provide an incentive to people to invest money and to save money. And that's why it is lower, and hopefully all of us will take advantage of it. Now, I also sit in the Transportation Economic Development Committee, and we've heard over these past couple days some testimony on the importance of entrepreneurs and providing investment income to entrepreneurs and helping them get off the ground. In fact, today I was able to, I'm honored to vote for the Oregon Investment Act, and I think that's an important bill. Now, one of the witnesses that came and testified of that talked about the differences of capital providers to our industry. Yeah, there's banks, but there's also called private equity folks. They usually invest at the higher big amounts. They usually buy companies or partner with companies, give them investment capital to allow them to grow. There's also venture capitalists, which are usually right below the venture or the private equity folks. And then there's angel investors as well, usually in the $100,000 to $200,000 range. And one of the witnesses testified that there's a gap. There's a dearth of investors in between the $200,000 to $500,000 investors. There's a dearth there. And that's one reason why we passed the Oregon Investment Act, was to encourage, to attract more investment for those companies that are looking for that amount of investment. One thing that I found interesting as I asked that witness was, I said, I recognize that there's a dearth of these quality investors here. And I said, would it not be true if we had a more competitive investment income tax rate in Oregon, more competitive with other states, that would attract those quality investors here to Oregon to fill that gap of missing investors? And he said, yeah, that would be logical. So one reason there, that's just one story. I think I'd just like to end by saying, in my business as well, as a business attorney and an intellectual property attorney, I work with a lot of startup venture folks. They're the ones that that leave Intel. They're the ones that leave REI. They're the ones that take that risk to quit their job and to go out and roll the dice and see if they can make something happen. And as I've worked with them, I've also worked with the people invest with those entrepreneurs. And interestingly, I work with some investors that are out of state that are wanting to invest in Oregon. And that one of the very first questions they ask is, what is your investment income tax rate here in Oregon? And I tell them what the answer is. And more often than not, that's one of the biggest hitches that we have to get over, is their answer is, why in the world would I want to invest in a place that has that high rate? Why would I want to do that? And we have to scramble mightily to try to overcome that hiccup there. So why do I support House Bill 4076? Let's give it a test run. Let's prove it out. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Let's try it. And I hope that you'll give it a hearing, give it a work session, and let's try it. Let's test it. And I have faith that it will work. If it doesn't, we'll find out. Thank you.
Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This may be a question for Chris, or it may be a question for Representative Wan, whoever wants to answer it. But I just want to be clear that this applies to people with Oregon tax liability after the investment. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I'll take it a step further. The definition of Oregon business, as it's defined in the bill, references a chapter of 470, which says Oregon businesses are those that are organized or authorized to do business under Oregon law for a profit, meaning they're registered here. And as a general proposition, they would have to have physical locations here.
Well, please.
So, and that that's non-publicly traded companies, is that correct?
Publicly traded companies are specifically excluded, and I did that. I asked for that and actually had to send it back to LC to get that added, and the reason is that I want people to sell their publicly traded stocks and take those investments and invest them here. And we don't want folks that are playing the stock market to take advantage of this bill, because we don't know that that will necessarily create any jobs here.
What happens if somebody invests in one of these companies and then after 3 years they don't realize any gain, that company goes under?
They wouldn't have paid gains anyway. I mean, if you invest in a company and you lose money, you've just lost money. This is only the gains. You have to win in order for us to win as well.
Yeah, there's no taxes on no income.
Well, sometimes there are in the case of gross receipts taxes, but otherwise that's true.
Nicely done. Thank you. Yes. Others? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah. Do you gentlemen know of, did you model this after something from another state? I'm real interested in this, sort of getting at the capital investment being directed to our state, because I agree with you, the need for capital to get business going in this state. And also, if you'll indulge me in the interest of time, the other thing I'd like you to speak to is how this thing ends automatically, so that we don't get into that loop about tax breaks and sunsets, and it is specific to this particular capital emergency.
I understand that other states have done this or something similar to this, but I didn't know it at the time. I actually, when I'm driving, I tend to daydream, and I was thinking back to Governor Attia, who had a limited surcharge for 2 years, and I thought, well, if 2 years was good enough for the governor, maybe we can throw it on here. But that's how I came up with it, and I don't exactly know what the experience was in other states, but because I've only recently become aware of that. But what I like about the fact that it expires of its own accord is that I'm hoping that there will be a rush at the end of 2013 to invest before the expiration date, because that provides such a strong benefit. And also that fuels the $700,000 increase in revenue from tax year 14 that the Revenue Office has told me is the result of this bill. So we actually, because of income taxes, so we actually get a benefit to this bill short term. And frankly, even the benefit, even the lost revenue as a result of people realizing the gains, here again, we're trying to guess in inexact science when people might realize these gains. They could hold it for 20 years before they realize the gain under this bill, before there would be any revenue impact. And what they did is they said they expected 30% would sell after the minimum, and then 10% per year after that. That was the assumption that they put in there. But here again, as we know, capital gains are the most difficult type of revenue to predict.
I might follow up as well. I didn't participate in drafting the language. I've only reviewed it. But what I do see is I could see a wonderful television commercial with Governor Kitzhaber being played out in other states, neighboring states, saying, hey, guess what? Guess what our investment income tax rate is? Come do business here in Oregon. Come invest in Oregon. It's a great deal. Come on in. And I could see investors, and that would trickle down to business owners, to my law firm. We'd probably send a little e-blast out to all of our clients saying, guess what? Oregon has this great investment income tax rate. It's now competitive, or even more competitive with other states. Come do business in Oregon. Has to be direct investment. And I guarantee that there would be a stream of interest coming to Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you said guarantee. I'm excited.
Other questions? As I read the bill, this is a fascinating idea. And as I read the bill, I thought of a couple different scenarios, and I'd like your comments on them. One scenario is somebody who starts a small proprietorship business, puts $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 and maybe mortgages his house to do it, and grows the business for a few years and maybe sells at that point, and in the process
realizes some gain. And hopefully he took some money home in the meantime and lived on that, which he, of course, would pay ordinary income tax rates on, and would get a advantage of this provision then, having done it within the time period and kept it for more than 3 years. Another person, perhaps a little bit shrewder, took the same amount of money, $100,000 or whatever, and set up a corporation, put the money into the corporation and took the stock of the corporation as his ownership evidence of ownership of the corporation, but not of the money itself, and built a business. And over the period of 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years, that business continued to grow and reinvest and develop in Oregon. When the stock was sold by the owner, or maybe perhaps his heirs, many years later, I assume that they would still qualify on the sale of that stock for this at this low rate, assuming again that the investment was made during this window. Would you? Is that your understanding of the way this bill would work?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay, great.
And if I may comment, I'll just...
Yep, please. Yeah. I mean, this is not a negative example. I'm simply trying to understand it.
We now have a circumstance where more and more Oregonians are running out of unemployment. They've reached their 99th week, and their options are limited. And the more folks we can encourage, if necessary, to try to start their own businesses, even if it's with a wheelbarrow and a shovel, you know, if this can incent even a few dozen of those people to give it a shot, more to the better. There's value in hard work, and I don't know that it necessarily this would be the impetus for those folks, but if it is, that's great news, and that will help get Oregon moving again.
Good. Other? Yes, Representative Gelser, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your description of the bill. In some of the other bills that we've moved through the Revenue Committee, we've looked at caps in order to protect the amount of revenue that goes out. Have you contemplated at all putting a cap on the amount of profit that an individual could claim this lower tax rate on, that 9% to the 2.5%?
I hadn't, frankly, but, you know, I'm open for discussions. I think that this will help Oregon, and if that can get the bill moving, let's talk about it.
And just as a follow-up, my question really goes to the anticipated revenue impact, which looks like it's at about $11.7 million in the 15-17 biennium. And like many of us on this committee, I'm still scarred by our discussions around the Betsy, which was a success far beyond what we could afford. What do you see as the protections in this bill to keep that from happening under this program?
As many of you know, I've expressed a philosophical dissatisfaction with the idea of a tax expenditure. And the reason for that is that not all tax expenditures are created equal. Some come about as a direct result of an incentive that wouldn't already come here. What the Revenue Office told me is that they would see a 5.6% increase in investment in Oregon as a result of this bill. That is investment that would not otherwise occur as a result of this bill. According to them, it's their numbers. And so when I look at that, I say, yes, we might get $11 million in lost revenue. We might get $20 million in lost revenue as a result of this bill in the 15-17 biennium. But we ought not pretend that we would otherwise realize that revenue without this bill, because they have projections in the Revenue Department about what they expect for these types of investments over the next several years, and they increased those as a result of this bill. So I suppose I would say that in response, if we, quote-unquote, lost $50 million in revenues in 15-17, then the increase in the number of jobs and the number of people going to work and not on public assistance would be to such a great benefit that I think that it would really not be seen as a negative, in my opinion.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. How would you explain to a constituent of mine who was really struggling just above the line of public assistance? They're facing a foreclosure on their home. They're not sure how they're going to pay their child care expenses, their medical expenses, and they're paying 9% on their income tax and their Oregon income tax. How would you explain to them why a person making this investment would pay less than a third of what they were paying?
Well, a person that's barely staying above public assistance isn't paying 9% on their income. They're probably getting an earned income tax credit. They're probably paying at the lower rate and the individual rate. And what I would say to that person facing foreclosure is to remember that if we push away businesses, if we push away employers, she has a greater chance of being laid off and not having a way to feed her children. But that if we focus on working together as Oregonians, if we focus on promoting employment in our state, everybody benefits, including her. So she probably wants job security. She probably wants to know that she's not going to be laid off. And this is a way to help ensure that. And going the other direction, we have seen through past experience, particularly in the last 2 years, leads to more layoffs, might make us feel better, but it leads to more layoffs, more foreclosures, more public assistance, and more people that are not able to work.
That's how
I would respond to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just might add one clarification as well, a tactical one, not specific to this one, and that is this investment income tax is paid on dividends after a corporation has already been taxed once, so it's essentially being taxed twice. So it's, I don't think it's completely accurate to say that it's just someone paying that amount. It's paying that amount on investment income beyond what's already been paid in the corporate tax, so it's, there's two taxes there.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Just one to make certain I understand. The rate you're proposing on these particular capital gains is what?
2.5%.
2.5%, and the normal rate on capital gains currently is?
I'll defer to LRO on that.
The marginal rates, the 5, 7, 9, or 9.9, depending on where the taxpayer lands.
Right, based on your income, and for corporations,
it's the 6.6 or 7.6.
Right, after all of their deductions. The actual rate is quite a bit lower than that for most corporations, isn't it?
If you're talking about, those rates are on taxable income. So if you're trying to get an effective tax rate, then it would be, it lowers those.
Okay. And just to reiterate, getting back to the point we were just talking about, if I understand your proposal, it would not be available to businesses that are publicly traded.
Investments in businesses that are publicly
investments,
traded.
So the publicly traded business themselves could make an investment in Oregon, and to the extent they might be subject to a capital gains rate tax, would pay this lower rate.
That's my understanding.
So a national company could set up a subsidiary in Oregon, and then whatever the rate was on whatever their income one was when they sold, I mean whatever the capital gain was on that company when they sold it later, however that got adjusted, whatever the final amount was, we'd be charging at the 2.5% rate.
Yeah, and I think what you run into, and I'll have to defer to the CPAs on this because I don't do a lot of corporate tax, but the way that we phrase this, a qualified investment is an investment in an Oregon business or in real property located in Oregon. And so what we're focusing in on is the taxpayer and where the tax liability accrues. And I frankly don't have a very comprehensive understanding of how often C-corporations buy into other corporations or how often they pay capital gains in the ordinary course. And the revenue folks that were going over the numbers with me and creating the jobs projections did not provide me any particular, I didn't ask the question, but they didn't provide any particular indication that their numbers would be skewed or different as a result of your question, Mr. Co-Chair.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have several other people who would like to testify today on this measure, and let's start with J.L. Wilson and Mike McLaren.
Thank you. Briefly, co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries in support of House Bill 4076. A couple of salient facts that have
come out in recent hearings. You know, first of all, it's important to put out on the table that Oregon has what's called a U6 unemployment rate, people who are either unemployed or underemployed in excess of 18%, which means one in five Oregonians basically can't or can barely support themselves and their families. Another interesting fact that came out in the hearings on the Oregon Investment Act, which is all new net job creation in this state comes from companies under 5 years in existence, which means the growth in our economy is fueled by small business because by necessity they're the new companies. So as it relates to House Bill 4076 and in the short session, I mean, one of the themes of this session is what can we do to turn around the unemployment rate? And we're hearing bills in all committees all throughout the building to change the dynamic in this state, and that's why we believe that 4076 has to be part of that solution. One of the bills that we're supporting is House Bill 4040, the Oregon Investment Act, which is all about consolidating and leveraging state resources to invest in upstart companies with the promise of increasing hiring and creating new industries and jobs and businesses in this state. What an unbelievable complement to that policy for something like 4076 to be in existence, because it's not all about what government can do to help create jobs. You've got how you can treat taxes and investment to help spur those jobs as well. And this, to our way of thinking, is an unbelievable complement to that policy, because you've got the state consolidating and leveraging its resources on one end, and then you've got tax treatment for investment in specifically Oregon companies that tackles it from the other end. And the two working together seem like an extremely potent policy to us. I would just say the effectiveness of 4076 might be limited in the fact that it's just a two-year window. But be that as it may, we do think it's very worthwhile to have the discussion of including 4076 in a comprehensive policy with regard to leveraging investment resources into our small startup companies that are doing 100% of the new net job growth in this state.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Mike McLaren, representing the Chambers of Commerce in Oregon, and we stand in support of House Bill 4076. I think Representative Wand and Representative Lindsay did a great job laying out the impact of those bills and or that bill and actually giving the description of what the state is with regard to opportunity. Just this last month, I can tell you that I reviewed two very solid business plans of both a young entrepreneur with a great idea and a solid business plan that has a national and international market, an existing business that has a solid business plan to expand in a national market. Both of those cases are in need of that investment capital that could very well be benefited from the passage of this bill. The bottom line, again, is that this stimulates the ability for us to create jobs for Oregonians. And as we take a holistic approach to building community, it is about finding the revenue for our educational systems and for those things that create that holistic livability in communities. But it starts with that ability to retain those jobs. The alternative to this is that in the two examples that I cited, they can actually follow that demographic of our population, can follow where the investment money will end up. So if it's not Oregon that's attracting it here, they can take those ideas, plant that business in another state, and grow and develop. And it's really a loss for us in a number of different ways. I'm also, just this last month, in contact with another business that's well-established in Oregon, has a very dynamic market, isn't going to go anywhere, but is contemplating whether to take it up and grow to the next level. That decision is based upon, one, capital investment to create that growth, and a bottom line analysis as to whether growing is going to be a net gain for them as a company in the long run here. That has impact, again, on job creation and ultimately the revenue that this state receives that in turn goes back to supporting the key and essential services that we all want to see met. So we're here just to encourage your support of House Bill 4076. And as was stated, let's give it a try and let's make a statement that Oregon is open to investment capital, open to business for the purpose, again, of making a great place for our citizens to find work, stay here, and retain that intellectual capital and opportunity for the future.
Great. Other questions? For a gentleman, one of the issues that comes up to my mind as we are discussing this possibility really stems, I think, from the question that Representative Gelser raised a little while ago. Just by way of history, when in 2007, when this committee looked at a bill on supporting energy development, and was looking at a small tax credit to help businesses set up various operations having to do with tax credits, and the details don't matter a whole lot. We passed that bill with very few sideboards and without much in the way of thought about the secondary effects that this kind of a legislation might have, with no caps and no sideboards and no limitation really on who might qualify for it. The result was that instead of spending about $12.5 million, we spent well over $300 million through that tax credit system. Now, I would say that those of us who were on the committee in 2007 have really learned our lesson, that when you look at something that involves taxes, that there will be very creative people who will figure out ways to take advantage of it. Much of it will be perfectly justified in terms of the goals that we have. Other portions of it might not be. I'm wondering if you're willing to go to work with the advocates of the bill and perhaps some other people and help to figure out what some of the sideboards are that might be necessary on something like this. It occurs to me, for example, that the question I raised with the members a few minutes ago about large businesses setting up their own subsidiaries solely for the purpose of being able to take advantage of a capital gains tax rate later without actually accomplishing any of the outcomes that you're hoping for in this bill. I don't know whether that's a real example or not, but it's something I haven't had a chance to think about very much. And I know, given our history, that if we don't put the sideboards around, we won't get what we want, and we will spend a great deal of money out of the school budget, out of the healthcare budget, out of the public safety budget in the process. So I'm interested in, this is a very intriguing, extremely intriguing idea to me. I want to make sure that we don't have those unintended side effects and that the staff's recommendations about what the costs of it are don't turn out to be extremely conservative. Thoughts on that?
Thank you.
Representative?
We can let them respond. I do have a comment.
Okay, I'm sorry, please, to interrupt. Yeah.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. Yes, creating collateral damage is in no one's interest.
Yes.
And so if there are ways to limit unforeseen consequences, that has to occur, because the bottom line has to be focusing a policy that relates to job creation and try to keep everything else, you know, the collateral damage, down to nothing. And so we're completely supportive of going to work to do that.
I would agree, Co-Chair Barnhart, that we would definitely want to work in making sure that there are no unintended consequences. I will point out, though, with regard to capital gains, there have been plenty that this state and local communities have suffered from, as there have been individuals. I think it's been long held that the capital gains debate has been focused around the impact it has on a few, when the reality of the situation is that this particular tax impacts the common Oregonian. A couple, for example, that has started out in their own business and for years has risked everything, invested everything, has no means of retirement or anything other than what they have put in with regard to sweat equity into this business. and then when it comes time to sell that business, are impacted by this capital gains. Now, for those businesses that have been able to see, as you have stated, a better way to maneuver themselves, they have maneuvered themselves right out of the state prior to the sale of a business. And then, again, Oregon and local communities are the ones that lose because they are not in that community anymore. Their leadership is not there. Their charitable contributions are not there. And their future income tax is not there. So by all means, we would want to work with preventing unintended consequences, given the context that there have been many that exist with this issue already.
Thank you. Other Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've really enjoyed this this conversation. I think it's highly worthwhile and something I hope we keep at. I also appreciate the comments that have been made about the Oregon Investment Act, and I think that may be a vehicle for a lot of these conversations. I've been interested in this conversation for a while, too, about our high rate on capital gains, and as a result had two bills. Representative Warren and I have been consulting a little bit that had some similar elements in the 2011 session. I'm particularly interested in the way that our relatively high rate among the highest in the country often stops the conversation before going on to other things. Representative Warren and I probably can debate what the appropriate rate is, but the effect is something I think at least the two of us are interested in taking on. So the bills that I proposed last time have some similar elements: a reduced rate, a redirection of those dollars into the rainy day funds, response to the volatility, which was mentioned before, and another version, which is very similar to what Representative Warren talked about, a limited duration to try to motivate an increased level of investment. But I think it all speaks to the notion of kind of feeding the entrepreneurial machine, if that's not too crude an analogy, and making sure that all of these different kinds of businesses have access to the capital they need. That's very much the spirit behind the Investment Act, and I'm hopeful if we're not able to find a smart version that relates to some of these proposals in this short session, that we can continue the conversation either with the Investment Act, the board that it creates, or perhaps amongst this committee. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ayer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, Mr. McLaren, you bringing up about the smaller business aspect of this. What I see as a practitioner, and we're talking about capital gains, which is really gains on capital income, not ordinary income. When I look at individuals that have capital gain triggered upon sale of a company that they've built, and however long they've held it, in this case a minimum of 3 years, a typical planning is for them to move to Washington State before sale. We lose 100% of all tax on the capital gain of that transaction in Oregon. When we lower it to a rate approximating 2.5% or so, all of a sudden the cost of moving, relocating, and establishing residency starts to come up to that 2.5% range, and we now, rather than losing 100% of the tax, are now coming out at 2.5 higher in this case. The other aspect of this is on corporations, and you mentioned about publicly traded. Publicly traded corporations have to be taxed as C corporations, and they may hold an investment as a partner in a partnership, but what we have to look at when they trigger a capital asset, it is sometimes treated as business income and sometimes treated as non-business income. And when treated as business income, it's going to be brought into their apportionment factors anyway, regardless. It will not be treated as capital gains. If it is treated as capital gains in this, it will be subject to apportionment. If it's non-business income, it's going to be subject to allocation to the state in which it has situs. And so that number, the impact to those big companies, starts getting smaller and smaller when you're thinking about that they're getting an undue benefit from this. And the other thing we have to look at is we are trying to spur successful investment. So I hope that we have a huge capital gain number in this small window of time of investment that we are talking about, because right we are in crisis where we are needing to create jobs, and we are saying, bring your money here, try it. They aren't going to get this benefit until they sell, and they're only going to get the benefit upon sale if they're successful. Come here, try it out, invest, run the gamble on us, because right now we are competing with states that have zero capital gain rate. And we're just saying, let's at least give a flying chance at getting some of those investment dollars, which, by the way, are happening. They're just going somewhere else. That's what we're trying to do here.
Thank you. I don't think there was a question embedded in that.
No, I just had to clarify some questions.
Appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from Sean Jillians and Jan Meekum. And then after that, I have John Calhoun, Chuck Sheketoff, and the story group again. Is there anyone else other than the people I've named who would like to be heard on this bill? Thank you, Steve. Yeah. Please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekum, State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. Most of there's consensus among my predecessors that were up here, Mr. Wilson and Mike McLaren, regarding the support and the benefits of this bill. For our small business members, whether you're investing in a business or investing in real estate, taxes do matter. And it makes decisions and makes people make decisions based on the tax policy of the environment. And as you know, small business is the job creator. And small businesses are made up of the entrepreneurs, risk takers, and job providers. And we believe this bill can add not only an economic boost to Oregon, but also an emotional boost to our small businesses that are here or that would want to come here. And it opens the door to added jobs, new businesses, and business retention, all positive indicators. And I think that's what the strong intention is in this building during this session. It's no secret that NFIB members favor a permanently reduced, if not eliminated, capital gains tax, but we feel that House Bill 4076, although temporary, will add enticement and incentive for doing business in Oregon and retaining businesses that are already here. And thank you very much for your time, and open to any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I would echo some of the comments from my colleagues previously. I think we would support an overall reduction in the capital gains rate without any sideboards on it. But I think this is a unique kind of limited approach that we would also be supportive of. There's kind of two sides to this story. And Representative Juan said, well, we don't want anyone flipping houses. We wouldn't mind people flipping houses as well, again, Mr. Chair, I'll be honest with you.
It all depends on where you sit.
Exactly. The bill, I think, typically you would think of a commercial investment in commercial real estate, and certainly commercial real estate is struggling quite mightily right now as well. But something that we've kind of seen that I was thinking about as this bill came forward is we're starting to see more investors and investment pools in foreclosures. And what the business model is that they do is they go in and buy bank-owned foreclosed properties that are vacant. Usually they're a little bit run down. They fix them up and they rent them out. It's not a flipping situation. They're actually renting them out. It would fit perfectly with this bill because it's something that they could rent out to the person. The end run is they hope to sell those properties back to the renter. So you're looking at a three-year window. I think this is a great approach that could specifically kind of address that. I don't know that that was specifically what Representative Wand had in mind when he thought of this, but it's something that we're certainly seeing in other parts of the country. Atlanta, Georgia has some very big investment pools now where they're doing this, and it's getting these houses that are otherwise vacant, rehabbed, back up to shape, getting people in safe housing. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think that's kind of one of the real positives we see of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Now we'll have John Calhoun, Chuck Sheketoff, and Steve Robinson.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm an entrepreneur and investor in early-stage companies. I'm currently the CEO of Inside Valuation Partners, a property valuation company serving the national financial industry with offices in four western states. However, today I'm representing the Equity Alliance of Oregon, a group of business leaders concerned that further avoidable budget cuts will damage the state's economy, and that what the state should be doing is investing in education and business infrastructure. I'm here today to oppose HB 4076. There is a myth that lower capital gains taxes or no capital gains taxes will increase business investment. My experience as an investor in new business and in raising money from other investors over a 30-year period is that the capital gains rate does not impact investment decisions. This country did not see a flurry of new investments when the federal capital gains rate was cut dramatically 10 years ago. In fact, in the prior decade, we saw an explosion of investment in new companies during the dot-com boom, all when the capital gains rate was higher. When the dot-com companies went bust, we did not see an increase in investment just because the tax rate had dropped. When I invested in my first Oregon startup in 1990, there was no discussion of tax rates. When we sold the business in 1995 at a great return for all investors, we paid higher taxes than we would today, but all the investors were happy because they got a good return on their investment. Good investment decisions are based upon a solid business plan that satisfies a strong customer demand. If a company can show that customers want to buy a product or service at favorable prices, then they will be able to find investors. There are a lot of risks in making investments in new ventures, technology, the sales channel, competitors, customer demand, cost structure, personnel. As those of us who have done this know, most new businesses do not succeed. When that happens, no one needs to worry about having a low tax rate. When investment does well, then paying taxes is a non-issue because you have the profits to pay the taxes. When Nike, Intel, Microsoft, etc. were looking for investors back when the capital gains rates were much higher, did potential investors turn them down because they might have had to pay taxes if they were successful? If someone did make that decision, did they regret it later when those companies were successful? You better believe they would have. My point is that good investment decisions are not driven by tax rates. When I first started private investing in the 80s, I was sold a couple of investments that were designed to reduce my taxes. Oil wells, a movie, real estate. I soon learned that tax benefits were not enough if the business was unsuccessful. I have never considered taxes when making an investment since. Oregon has seen a resurgence in venture investing in the last year, with venture capital growing 25%, beating the national average. Could we do even better with a lower capital gains rate? Not at all. Since the capital gains rates, venture capitalists pay is based upon the state where the investors reside, not where they invest. Cutting the tax rate in Oregon will have no impact on national capital, venture capital interest in Oregon. So what will be the impact of cutting capital gains taxes? The state will have less money to invest in schools, to support our justice system, and help seniors in need. That's all. It will not lead to additional jobs. Those who already have wealth, like me and other business leaders supporting the Equity Alliance of Oregon, will all have more money. The state government will have less. As business leaders, we believe that the worst thing the legislature could do right now for the business community is to reduce funding for education and other basic infrastructure. We need solutions that will jumpstart our economy, keep Oregon a competitive location for business, and start rebuilding the middle class. We need to invest, not cut. Lastly, as business executives and upper-income individuals, we believe that the most equitable and effective tax system is one that is based on the ability to pay. We believe that Oregon's ongoing prosperity is tied directly to the strength of the middle class and providing real economic opportunities for all Oregonians. And that is why we oppose HB 4076. And I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee, I'm Chuck Shekatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy, here in opposition to House Bill 4076. I'd first like to give a little perspective on the economy and how capital gains fit into that, and then talk about the merits of the bill. And I think it's important for that perspective, especially on a day when you got a revenue forecast and all of your ears perked up over $35 million, even though you're dealing with a $14 billion state budget. So I've handed out three papers. The first one to look at is the fact sheet dated December 14th called If Economic Growth Assured Well-Being, Oregonians Would Be Thriving. And this is an attempt by us to give a more long-term look at our economy. And you can see on a number of factors, growth of the economy, Oregon growth, state product growth in the economy, as well as productivity growth, that Oregon does very well relative to the national economy. Especially when the national economy does well, we do really, really well. Earlier today, a question, comment came up as we want to help boost Oregon productivity. As noted on page 4 of that report, from 2001 to 2010, Oregon led the nation in inflation-adjusted economic output per worker. And so it's important to recognize that our economy really does do very well. The country is in a, we're about a little more than 1% of the national economy now. When the national economy does well, we do very, very well. And you should recognize that. The next one shows who's been getting the benefits. Economic gains flow to the top as Oregon income inequality soars, dated December 14th. And this shows that it's not just Mr. Rich behind me who's doing well. But if you turn to page 2, you'll see a graph that's almost similar as the one on page 1. It's really the top 0.1% who are having the greatest gains in Oregon. And what the top 1% is getting is a bigger share of the income pie. I also want to point your attention to the last page. The last page, which brings us to the topic of this bill. The last page shows a breakdown of capital gain income in Oregon using Department of Revenue data. And the way to read this pie chart is as follows. Imagine there's 1,000 people in this room right now, and you have a pizza with normal extra-large pizza with 10 slices. You can probably all imagine that. Well, Mr. Top 1/10 of 1%, he takes 5 slices and leaves the room. 9 others, the rest of the 1%, they share 2 pieces, and they leave the room. And the 990 people left in this room have 3 pieces to divide up among themselves. That's what's happening with capital gains. Think of who gets it. It's heavily tilted to the wealthiest of the wealthy. Now, should capital gains, the problem with this bill is that it's based on a number of false assumptions and sort of hopes and prayers. There's no job standard in the bill. The previous panel talked about flipping. Of course you could flip houses under this. You know, if I'll use them as an example of the truly hypothetical. If Chair Barnhart decided he wanted to sell a building he has in the Eugene area that has some retail establishments in it so he could buy his wife the house in Tuscany or Paris that she's always wanted, he could sell it to me. I could hold it for 3 years, sell it. There's no new jobs at that building. All those businesses actually may have gone out of business. If I make a profit, I wouldn't be taxed on it. The issue of capital losses came up. Well, so you get, you know, when you have a capital loss, you get to offset them against capital gains. So if I sell some property I lose money on, do I get to do that at 9%? Or do I have to only do a 2% capital loss? That's not addressed in the bill. There's no standard in the bill for jobs. There's no one held accountable to create jobs in this bill. And there's no way of projecting whether the hypothetical model that Legislative Revenue Office uses actually worked. The third paper I have for you is called The 4 Flaws of a Capital Gains Tax Cut that we released in June of 2011. And it goes through all the arguments about why cutting capital gains taxes in general make no sense. I just want to highlight a few for you. That when you have a system, and this was addressed by Representative Gelser, where you're giving favored status, you're basically creating a work penalty. And in fact, in this report, we have a quote from the then governor of Vermont, Jim Douglas, a Republican, where he was arguing against that favored status in Vermont, and he said, we must close this loophole and eliminate this working tax penalty, that someone earning $50,000 would pay significantly more tax and who gets that from work than someone who gets it with unearned income. The report also has a number of studies analyzed, as well as our own analysis of migration data with Clark County and just taxpayers in general, showing that there is not this outflow of capital gains from Oregon. It's very minimal. In fact, more people with capital gains income move to Oregon than move out of Oregon. We have a net increase on that front. So I just, you know, I would encourage you to read it. I think that the capital gains issue is often held up. We don't have, we treat all income the same, income from work and unearned income, and we ought to continue to treat income from work. And if you're going to have a economic development bill, it ought to have clear standards for jobs that the measure and the is held accountable to. You know, you could pass this bill. It might not balloon, as been feared by some of you, in its cost, and you would not know in 2015 or 17 whether or not it created a single job. Net, you would not know that from this, because there's no standards associated with it. So it's sort of a textbook example of a bad economic development bill. Well intentioned, but it doesn't do the job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Robinson with Decision Metrics in Eugene. I'm strongly ambivalent about this bill. I want to commend Representative Wand for putting in some very important sideboards on the issue of capital gains. I'm strongly of the opinion that a general capital gains cut would be a disaster for Oregon, and for some of the reasons we've already heard. And in view of the fact that the top 1% of income earners get 80% of those capital gain benefits, and those aren't the people that are, those aren't the hard-charging entrepreneurs that we're trying to encourage. Those are essentially coupon clippers. But the important sideboards, I think the limited duration, the investment in Oregon, I think there are some elements there that deserve further discussion, and I would encourage you to proceed with those discussions, but with a very great degree of caution. I just would offer you a couple of ideas about further discussion that you might want to have. First is that the kinds of people that I think Representative Wand would like to encourage to make these investments are much more likely to be either doing proprietorship or S corporation types of investments, and those would not, I don't think, be covered at all by this provision, because investments in S corporations are ordinary income. You know, all your returns from an S corporation, and 90-95% of the kinds of the small businesses start as proprietorships or S corporations. And so I think that one of the discussions you might want to have is, how do we better target the benefits of this sort of approach to the kinds of people that we want to really encourage, and limit what I would call the windfall effect. Now, I've talked before about the windfall effect to a certain extent, and I'm not at all convinced that the vast majority of the kinds of investments that would be subject to this favorable treatment would not be simply windfalls, because, like others, I have had, you know, I have an MBA in finance, and I have been with in a lot of private businesses, and I don't think that there are very many business decisions which are motivated by the tiny sliver of tax treatment that Oregon is going to be giving to the businesses that qualify for this investment. Business investments are typically involve much larger trade-offs, and are looking for a venture investor is looking to triple or quadruple or quintuple his money in a venture investment. Okay, and a small entrepreneur is looking perhaps just to even generate a job. You know, they're not looking for, am I going to be able to save 3-4% on my taxes 5 years from now? That's not going to enter into the conversation. So what I would recommend is that you talk about, how do we determine, if we do anything of this sort, how do we get some data about what the actual effects have been? And so I would recommend that there be some discussions about, how do you register for such a benefit? How do you register your investment so that when the time comes to take your credit or to take your deduction, it is clear that this qualifies? And at the time of registering, you need to gather some information about the kind of investment it is, and so you can go back later and determine, is this the kind of investment that might have been made anyway or might not? We don't. One of the problems with this whole area is that we do not have good data. It's all very macro, very soft, business confidence, you know, these kinds of things. You can't measure it very well. We don't have good data. And if we're going to be putting energy into looking at this sort of benefit, we ought to at least be intellectually honest enough to start gathering that data so that future decisions can be made with a better information about what the effects are going to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? It's late in the afternoon, and we've been at it for slightly more than 2 hours. You've all raised very interesting questions. I would like to simply say that the experience that Mr. Calhoun has had mirrors my own in terms of investing. There are still a couple of those hanging on from the 1980s. Very bad ideas, and I appreciate your being willing to talk about them in public. Thank you. Thank you very much. And now I guess we get the sideshow.
Well, we think these guys rained on our parade.
They did.
All right. Does that mean I get to take you off, or do you want to come?
Well, could I'd like to add
please.
One thing, if I may.
Please.
Just, I will be
Mr. Story.
Yes. I will be brief. I was going to speak in the persona of Filthy Rich about how to work this bill, but I'll set that aside because of the outstanding testimony we've just heard. I would like to express...
And would you, just for the record, state your name again, please.
Patrick Story.
Thank you.
I would like to thank Representative Wand for engaging with us on the role, the relationship between the 1% and the 99%, and it doesn't surprise me to hear that Representative Wand is... originally of the 1%, but that worked himself up, as, of course, 99% of us have done. And that was a reminder of the role of the public schools and the state university and all the other services that we need for a middle class. And so I appreciate that very much. The other thing is, to go back to the elephant metaphor, I just want to mention briefly another elephant that's in the room, and that is the race to the bottom on state taxation that's being imposed upon us by the largest corporations on earth. And we hear hopes that that might also benefit our small business people that do so much for the state. That's a frail hope, but the race to the bottom is very real, and many voters wonder if our elected representatives are going to engage that in a more responsive way than we have seen in recent years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr.
Questions?
Chair?
Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been thinking about this since the other bill when folks came up, and I appreciate that this room gets dry sometimes, and it's always nice to have people dressed like chickens and have interesting hats to warm up a committee room. I just think it's always important when we have these conversations that we have differences of opinion on how to best write our state, how to build our economy, how to get people back to work. But I do not believe that there is anyone in this state, including Filthy Rich, that thinks that any of us are benefited by having students drop out of school. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is important, even when making a humorous point, that we don't suggest that that's the case. We have many debates about education in this building, and I don't for a minute doubt that all 89 of my colleagues here and the governor want to see kids succeed in school and take care of folks. We have some really substantial disagreements about how we do things, but I just hope as we continue this conversation, it can be respectful and recognizing that we all care about kids. We all want our kids to succeed, and what we're doing here is engaging in a debate about how to make it happen best.
Thank you.
Thank you for that reminder that there are limits on parity, and I'm now going to lose the persona of Filthy Rich and come back to myself. I don't know if there are other questions or comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Reed, did you want to be heard?
No.
No.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4076. With my thanks to Representative Wand and the other sponsors for bringing that bill to us, it generated a lot of very interesting discussion. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 4087, 4088, and 4157. And we'll hear first from Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, the 4088 and 4157 have some overlap in their policies, so just describing them sequentially. House Bill 4087, I think it was intended, was a kind of a companion bill. It just creates four different funds, an Oregon Senior and Disabled Emergency Fund, an Oregon Education Emergency Fund, and an Oregon Public Safety Emergency Fund. I'm sorry, three funds, not four. 4088 contains a couple of policies. It converts the Oregon Elderly Itemized Deduction for Medical Expenses to a subtraction limited to $1,800 per return or per taxpayer and potentially $3,600 for joint returns if both individuals are eligible. It increases the eligibility age from 62 to 66 by 2015 and phases out the subtraction for incomes between $125,000 and $165,000 for single filers and then double those amount for joint filers. It also extends the higher Measure 66 tax rates for 2 years through 2013 and reduces by 5% the salaries of certain elected officials. You do have in your packet an SMS and a draft revenue impact statement. And then the third of the bills, 4157, has one policy in it, and it converts the Oregon Elderly Itemized Medical Oregon Itemized Deduction for Medical Expenses to a subtraction limited to $2,700 per taxpayer or $5,400 for joint returns. So it's kind of a subset of the other two. And then one other handout you have is kind of a background piece on the additional medical deduction for elderly. It has a few charts on it, and it has some distributional information from tax year 2010 and a history of the deductions taken for this tax expenditure, as well as a projection for the revenue loss through 1921. And those are current law. That's just kind of background information.
And the years you're referring to are 2019 to 2021.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I don't. Oh, and he is here. I was about to say I didn't see Representative Buckley, but he's here. Please. We're sorry to take you away from your Ways and Means effort, but we appreciate your being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good chair. We were right on the verge of a major agreement, but that's okay. that's okay. Really.
So, Mr. Chair, while Representative Buckley, because I'd like to take notes on a different bill, can I come up and
please,
then come back
and then,
down?
And come back.
Well, absolutely. Sure.
Well, I'm in this committee. And
well, that's right. So. I forgot about that. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
But the rest of us do not. Please, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, and I'm Co-Chair Representative Peter Buckley representing South Jackson County and the Legislature. Thank you so much for your time. I realize it's an extraordinarily long day for you, and you've been given a tremendous amount of information. I'm going to briefly talk about what I guess I'll call the road not taken. We have choices as legislators, and we all see them. You all see them with the bills in front of you and the ideas in front of you. I felt it was necessary to bring forth the bill at least to let the legislature know the choice that we're not making. We are making choices with the budget that we are rebalancing right now that will do things like cut unless we can find a remedy, long-term care in the state of Oregon. We are doing cuts to judicial that have a judicial system that's been already cut significantly. We are cutting higher ed. We are, I think, now 48th in the country in our investment in higher education. We're cutting our community colleges. We are cutting programs that Oregonians depend on. That's a choice that we are making. We don't have to make that choice. We could choose differently. There are revenue sources, and again, the one request I'm making with the bill I'm presenting is asking basically what if. What if we could have a discussion on revenue that included that choice very clearly, that asked the question, is it better to cut services that Oregonians vitally need? Is it better to continue to disinvest in the programs that we know help build our state? Or is it better to ask those who have resources to continue to contribute slightly more in order to maintain investments or even possibly increase investments? I'll take just a minute of your time, Mr. Co-Chair. My wife and I, as a couple, we make about $100,000 a year. That's our family income. And we are glad to pay our Oregon taxes. In addition, we voted 3 times for a local option in our community so that our public school system can have art, can have music, so our kids can play sports. We contribute $50 a month to the Ashland School Foundation. I'm telling you this just because I'm trying to give you at least the information that that I'm trying to put my money where my mouth is. I'm not asking people to contribute in an area where I'm not willing to contribute. The bill that I'm offering to you, I would actually even cut our pay, legislative pay. I'm willing to cut my own pay by 5%. I care passionately. I know all of you care passionately about the programs for Oregonians that we struggle to fund. I know you share that passion, but I've gone through now 3 years of reducing budgets and meeting with people every single day, and they're talking about the impact on their families, the choices that we're making and the impacts on their families. And I feel it would be incredibly irresponsible of me to not at least bring forward to this legislature and make sure we understand what the choice is that we're making. We have laid off thousands of teachers in our state. We all say that we value K-12, yet we have laid off thousands of teachers, have one of the shortest class school years in the nation, have some of the largest class sizes in the nation, and we sit back and say, well, that's just the way it is. And colleagues, it's not just the way it is, really. It has to be. We do have a choice. If we were to extend the Measure 66 income tax rates for 2 years, we could actually keep our community college budgets intact instead of cutting them this month, which we'll be doing with the rebalance bill, reducing what they could be having by 3.5%, by $14 million. If we were to extend those tax rates for 2 years, we would not have to close down our courts 9 days this year and possibly additional days next year. We'd be able to fund our drug courts that have proven results instead of cutting our drug courts. We would know that we could maintain our in-home health care system without threatening the health care of the workers who get paid $10 to $12 an hour to provide health care to our seniors and our people with disability. That's a choice that we are making. We are saying as a legislature we would rather threaten the health care of workers making $10 to $12 an hour, and we'd rather cut their hours of care for our seniors and disabled than ask people who are making substantial amounts of money to continue to contribute at the same level that they're currently contributing. I'm not at that level. My taxes will not be reduced through this biennium, and if they were, I would offer to keep them at the same way, and I'm sure there are many Oregonians who would. So I'm obviously it's a passionate subject with me. Obviously, it's a subject I know that would not get traction. We would not vote on this bill. We would not get it passed because of very strong philosophical differences. But again, I felt it would be, as seeing what I see on a daily basis, it would be absolutely irresponsible of me to not present to the legislature at least a choice and make it very clear. We are making a choice. We're not going to do senior medical deduction reform. And in not doing so, we are cutting programs for seniors and people with disabilities. We're not going to do Measure 66 extension, and in not doing so, we are cutting education, we are cutting public safety, we are cutting human services. I just wanted to make sure that everyone understood that's the choice that we're making. And again, I greatly appreciate your time, your consideration, your patience, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions any of you might have. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Buckley. You've brought us 2 bills, one of which reduces some of these tax breaks.
Correct.
And the other one of which spends the money that is attained thereby, if I understand it correctly.
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair. The idea being that the second bill creates 3 emergency funds, because I do believe our state still is in an emergency situation due to this recession. It creates a education emergency fund, a public safety emergency fund, and a human services emergency fund. The dollars from revenue, increasing revenue through the cuts of our own salaries, the senior medical, and the Measure 66 would go directly into those emergency funds. People could track exactly where their dollars are going. People who would be seeing a change in their taxes due to the senior medical reduction reform would see that their tax, their dollars would be going directly into services for seniors and people with disabilities. People who would see their Measure 66 tax rates maintained at the current level would see that their dollars are going directly to fund community colleges or directly to fund 24/7 coverage of our state highways by the Oregon State Police. So the reason behind that, Mr. Co-Chair, is simply to make sure that there was a mechanism so people could see exactly where their dollars are being spent.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger?
Is this the bill, excuse me, that has the reduction in our salaries?
One of those bills has a 5% reduction in our salaries.
5%?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And for you, Representative, I would suggest 4.5.
If you'll take it, I'll take it. I was looking for the language of that.
It's section 6 on page 6 of House Bill 4088.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Buckley. I just think that's a...
Thank you, Kutcher.
Somehow in the process of this looking at this bill, I had missed that piece. The members of the public should know that not to be confused with members of Congress, our pays are much lower. And so the amount, the number of dollars we're talking about is not very much.
That is,
but it's some.
Mr. Coche, it's a valid point. With a $22,000 a year salary, 5% is not a huge sum. But it is symbolic of nothing.
When I go to town halls, sometimes people think I'm a member of Congress and are being paid something in the neighborhood of 10 times what we actually are being paid. So I thought I should point that out. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Just a comment, Mr. Co-Chair. Although I'm tempted, Representative, I do have this bill in Ways and Means. I'd love to talk to you. I really appreciate you bringing this forward. This is a critical issue. It's one that we've tried to deal with for a couple of biennia now, and we just haven't got there. And the fact is that we have other tax expenditures beyond the tax credits that we've sunsetted that are on the books that we have to examine, that deserve sunsets, that we deserve to give the same scrutiny that we give to budgetary expenditures that you do in the Ways and Means Committee. It's about time that we did that, and I appreciate you continuing on this issue.
Thank you, Representative. And again, the overall theme being, and I think together we are capable as a state of doing a lot better by simply making more rational choices of how we use our resources.
Thank you. And I would simply note that in this bill, you've made a couple of adjustments. One of them is you've capped the amount of the current deduction to an amount that, for some taxpayers at least, would be smaller.
Correct.
It appears to me as though you're phasing the age upward to the point where it gets to age 66 by the tax years of 2015. And that you also phase it out for very high-income people. It's an interesting approach to the issue that we've dealt with in talking about this particular kind of tax problem. From the tax point of view, from the point of view of the workings of this committee itself, it's important for us to note that this deduction will eat us alive over time as more and more people get into the age group that I'm now in who qualify for this, as baby boomers increasingly qualify for the deduction that we currently have. It will have greater and greater and greater impact on those budget decisions that you have to make.
Mr. Coacher, it's an excellent point, and I'd point out that in the rebalance plan that we'll be asking all of our colleagues to vote on this month, we are suggesting closing a DOC facility, the Santiam facility, the reason being that we can save $1.8 million this biennium and $8 million next biennium. We've made choices throughout the rebalance plan trying to figure out what the impact's going to be in 2 years, 4 years, or 6 years, and I think your point about the cost of some of the exemptions that we have or some of the deductions that we have, the roll-up costs, have to be part of that conversation as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it. When you say DOC, you mean Department of Corrections.
Department of Corrections, sir.
That's and you're talking about one of the prisons.
Correct.
Yes. Representative Ayer?
Thank you. I have a technical question, and I not reading the bills in depth. if we have someone who currently has medical deductions above 7.5% of their adjusted gross income, and they are considered elderly otherwise for this law or for the other elderly law, does this limit for those folks too, those elderly folks, their deductions down, or is it only for those folks that have less than the 7.5% we're limiting it?
Representative Ayer, just the lower portion. The amount that above the 7.5% would be taken on the Schedule A.
Anyway.
And this is just for the portion
that is below it.
Right.
That they don't qualify for it. So then we're allowing a deduction for that if they didn't qualify for greater than 7.5, but we're limiting that amount.
Right.
Yes. The connection with the federal tax law deals with the other piece, and it's not actually in this bill. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
For taxpayers who are eligible to claim it, their full 100% of their medical expenses can be deducted, but in two different places. Right. If it's up to 7.5%, it would be on the Oregon return, and it's an Oregon-only subtraction or deduction. And above 7.5%, that's part of federal law.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. So they already can avail themselves of this deduction if they itemize for Oregon purposes for less than the 7.5%.
Correct.
So then this is simply limiting the amount of that otherwise allowable deduction that they have currently, or is it also availing for folks who aren't itemizing for Oregon purposes?
It does the latter. It converts it from an itemized deduction to a subtraction.
Right? Okay.
So now it's
above the line.
Encaps it. Okay. So everybody would be able to claim it, not just those people who itemize their Oregon return.
Thank you.
And because people who don't itemize are likely to be in lower income categories anyway, this makes it available to them when they wouldn't be available under current law.
Right. So, and the revenue impacts include both an attempt at getting at both pieces. There's a revenue gain from reducing the cost of the itemized deduction, but then there is increased expense for making it a subtraction, making it available to all filers.
Thank you.
Or that meet the other criteria.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ayer. That was a point I had missed, and I appreciate your raising it. Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That covered where I was going to go.
Representative Buckley, thank you very much for taking the time out to come and talk with us about these bills. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thank you for your time, and I hope that you would get to adjourn at some point.
Mr. Chair, shall I go back there?
Yes. We'll hear from Representative Gelser, and then I have the next panel I have after that is Chuck Chekatoff, John Mullen, and Steve Frank. Now we're switching, I think, to 4157.
Yes.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16 in Corvallis, and enjoy sitting with all of you every day. The end of the prior discussion was a great tee-up for this bill, which I admit is not half as sexy as the bills put forward by Representative Buckley. This bill simply changes the senior medical deduction to a subtraction. And my goal in introducing this bill was to have us really focus on the long-term revenue impact of our senior medical deduction policy. We've talked about this over the last couple of sessions, but every time we've had this conversation, it has been in the context of how to raise revenue in order to pay for current expenditures. And in the course of those discussions, I've become increasingly alarmed about the trouble that we are going to be in very short order if we do not address this issue on the revenue merits alone. It's worth noting, as Representative Ayer pointed out, the federal government allows individuals who have catastrophic medical expenses to write those off on their federal tax return. Changing Oregon's senior medical deduction is not going to put people at risk for not being able to address those types of issues that hit them when they have catastrophic and unexpected medical costs. Oregon is the only state in the United States that has an elderly medical deduction allowing people that are 62 years of age or older to to take a deduction for all of the expenses in their household, regardless of whether or not the expenses and the medical expenses in that household are taken, are incurred by a person over the age of 62. So there's currently no means test. It doesn't matter how much money you make, how much you need this, how, what type of medical expenses you're incurring, or how old the patients are in your household, as long as you have a taxpayer that is 62 years of age or older. In the 2011-13 biennium, we are going to spend $148 million on the elderly medical deduction. With our rapidly growing aging population, in just 6 years, we will be spending $326 million on the elderly medical deduction. I am afraid that Oregon simply can't afford this rapid increase in cost at the same time that we struggle to afford services for low-income, frail, elderly Oregonians. When Representative Buckley was here before me talking about his bills that would generate revenue for this biennium, he was absolutely right that we make choices in how we spend dollars on the revenue side and the ways and means side. It's really hard to talk about the choices that we are making and future biennia, but we are talking about a program that is going to more than double and is going to make it even more difficult to meet the needs of frail elderly that are going to rely on the state of Oregon for in-home care and long-term care services. Because of the very same mechanic that's driving up the cost of the elderly medical deduction, the large number of people that are aging, we will also see an increase in the demand for services on our social services side. So I had worked with Paul, and I asked him to help me develop a bill that would require only 31 votes, because we all like much better simple majority votes. And that's why this bill isn't very sexy. It doesn't do a whole lot, except for to start to address the common sense, what I believe are the common sense elements of this bill. The first thing is that it changes it from a deduction to a subtraction, which allows lower income seniors to be able to access it. It caps the amount of the subtraction that you can take, and it also ensures that what you're eligible to take, that cap applies only to the individual that's 62 years of age or older. So this deduction can only be taken for medical expenses for a person who is over the age of 62, and I believe many in this room might argue that you are not elderly at your 62nd birthday. Unfortunately, even though this would shift the dynamic of this, as we tried to play with what that cap might be in order to get control of the growth, we couldn't do that in a way that kept it as a 31-vote bill. So the bill that you have in front of you changes the mechanics of the bill. It is a 31-vote bill. But in that movement from $148 million in this biennium to $326 million in 2019, we will only shave $10 million approximately off of that number in 2019. If we really want to address this problem and figure out how we are going to afford this program and how we are going to build sustainable budgets on both sides of the ledger, we're going to have to find a way to come to terms with some type of legislation that will take 36 votes. And everything that I talked to Paul about, any little adjustment that would start to bend that cost curve, every single one of them immediately required 36 votes. So I bring this before you as a 31 vote, as a start to the conversation. But as a member of this committee, I would just implore all of you who are my colleagues on this committee that this is a very, very serious issue that will be harder to deal with the longer that we wait. We have let this grow we've talked about this every single session that I've served on this committee. And if we don't act, we're going to keep talking about it, and it's going to become more pressing. So I'm very interested in working with you to make these changes, if we need to make greater changes, for the purpose of the revenue policy. If it generates revenue in this biennium or another, we can then go have a conversation about what we do with those expenditures. But my purpose in bringing this is not to raise revenue. It is to ensure that we don't keep spending in a reckless program that we cannot afford, because that's what this is right now. It is a reckless policy that we can't afford, and we have to step up to be able to take care of it. And I hope that we can work together to find a way to make that happen. And I'm happy to entertain any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gelser. Questions? Thank you. Yes.
Would you explain to me how you manage the two people, same filing, who qualifies, and how it's divided?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. It is not a perfect solution, but the cap is based upon the taxpayer that's over the age of 62. So if you are a two-person household filing jointly and only one of you is 62, you can only go up to that cap one time. If there's two of you, you can go up to it twice. What we don't want to create is an expensive situation in the Department of Revenue where you have a bunch of people going through medical expenses to figure out who incurred what.
Can I pursue this?
Yes, please. Yeah.
But if trying to get at, there are two of you. One's over 65. One's not. The one that's under 65 then could not deduct at all, or could.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, the way that it works is that we have capped the subtraction at $2,700 per taxpayer that is 62 years of age or older.
Okay. So
is it possible that someone could claim in their household?
No, I'm not looking at fraud. I'm looking at how the mechanics are.
Yeah.
I think I get it.
Yeah. So $2,700 per taxpayer, which means if there are two of you in the household filing jointly that are over the age of 62, your household cap would be $5,400. We looked at the size of that cap, and lowering that cap any further would pop us into any slight adjustment that we make creates revenue in the biennium.
Got it. Thank you. Right.
Thank you. Representative Benst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've talked about this obviously before. Has a strange sense of deja vu about it. And I think reflecting back on it, the last time we had the discussion, I asked where the seniors were on the issue, since they're most involved and always vote. So my question to you would be, have you spoken to them, and where are they on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I have been engaged in conversations about this for several biennia. The conversations with the senior advocates have always primarily been about where do we spend the revenues that are generated by this. I would tend to agree with them that if we were to make this change, that we should direct those revenues to support low-income and elderly seniors. My goal in this bill has been to bring to your attention a revenue crisis that we are about to have. So I have not engaged with those senior organizations in this discussion, because I assume the dynamics are the same that they are every year. And in the past, when there has been a breakdown in the conversation among the varied senior advocacy groups, it has been around how the dollars would be expended in which senior program. And that was one other reason why I believed we really needed to look at this as a revenue policy issue and let the rest be worked out in another committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, this is a conversation we've had at least every year I've been here. So this is the fifth conversation. And each time I ask the same question, at least I think I have the last few, and that is the seniors have to take the lead on this, or they should be. And I mean that truly. They should be. Because this is as much – I turned 60 a couple of months ago, so I think I can safely address the issue. Right. And I want it seems to me the group needs to step up. And so I'm talking to – there's a representative of the seniors leaning against the wall over there, and I'm looking over at him, and I'm saying we got to hear from him. Because when I go back to my town hall meetings and I raise this issue, there's a decided chilly feeling in the air from every senior in the room, and most of the people in the room are seniors. So this is a hugely challenging issue. I must say I'm more comfortable addressing it now, given my age. But I am serious. We can't have the conversation unless they're at the table. It won't work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I appreciate those comments, and I agree with them. I also want to mention I had the first experience ever today being in a room in this Capitol in which I was the oldest person in the room. So I note that I, too, am aging. I think that one of the fundamental disconnects that we have in this discussion is that
the populations of people that are looking for the expenditure on the expenditure side are a completely different group of people than are benefiting from the senior medical deduction today. And I would bet that those that are benefiting from the senior medical deduction today probably disproportionately are not in the rooms at your town hall hearings. If you go and look, there's an additional medical deduction for the elderly chart that's at your seat. The only individuals that can claim this deduction right now are those that are deducting. And I believe that 41% of the current expenditures in this program goes to the 12% of filers that have an income of more than $100,000 per year. So it's very difficult to say who is it that represents seniors, because it's a very broad and diverse group. But we do need to have people at the table, and it is an issue that impacts the entire senior population.
Thank you. Just a quick comment on the question. Now, I agree with Representative Bentz that we ought to have better data on where seniors are on this kind of issue. I know that when I raise an issue like this in groups of senior citizens, most of the time, the initial part of the conversation is that they don't know what I'm talking about. And once I've explained it, I don't think I've ever had a group. Now, I recognize that my town halls are a little different than yours, but but I get a lot of pretty conservative people at some of those town halls, too. And I haven't had anyone yet at any of those town halls who thought that the current system was good for Oregon. After I had parsed it for them and they understood what the issue was, because let's face it is not an easy issue to just stick a label on and everybody knows what it means, because it's much more difficult. But I completely agree with what I think you're probably suggesting, is that we actually need a lot more data on what seniors think about this on this issue.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Please.
What I'm thinking is there is no doubt something needs to be done. There is no doubt. But the only way things happen is if we have the support of that particular demographic.
Thank you.
So I think it's I don't think it's data gathering. I think it's education.
Thank you. That's a very different point than the one I thought you were making.
Sorry.
And I appreciate the clarification. That's certainly true. That's definitely true. Yes. Thank you. Representative Ayer?
Thank you. Just doing a little bit of quick math. The folks that might not receive a benefit that they're currently receiving. So if it's a joint return, $5,400, the max, that is 7.5% of $72,000 taxable income. So if they're under $72,000, they're still going to receive a benefit that they would be getting if they itemized, but folks that aren't itemizing under $72,000 are going to get that benefit as well. The lost piece of this are folks, like in this case, married filing jointly, that have greater than $72,000, and their medical deductions are above that but below 7.5% of their AGI. That piece they're not going to be able to deduct that they're currently able to. And so I guess that's a value statement at $72,000, and it's taxable income, not complete income, taxable income, or excuse me, adjusted gross income. If that is high enough for that loss. But I like the direction of where this is going, because we pick up folks that currently don't get any benefit, and we're really that aren't itemizing. So they benefit from this, and not knowing the data completely, but just doing rough math, I think it's going in a very good direction. I have seen very high income taxpayers who can't make the 7.5% adjusted gross income threshold under itemization, but for Oregon purposes are deducting $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 in medical deductions. You can imagine if that is not quite at 7.5% of their adjusted gross income where their income is. And so we've got some real high wealth individuals who don't really need this help. That are benefiting, and they're only few and far between, true, but this is really moving it in favor of the lower income seniors who don't have the benefit of itemizing.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, if I may, in terms of the question of where the shift in taxable benefit is. Last session, at the end of last session, we ran some numbers at different caps and at different income levels and at different medical expenses, and I can track that down and share that with you if that would be helpful at all.
That would be good.
And on the second point, I haven't had many discussions with this new CPA and the firm that we work with, but I got a little post-it note in the mail the other day that said, have you guys ever looked at this elderly medical deduction issue? I just handled this for a couple of clients and think it's something that you should look at for the very same reasons that you just indicated. I'm solicited from our CPA.
You didn't ask for it.
I did not ask for it. It was a post-it note. I've saved it.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate that. We have several people who would like to be heard today, and I think I mentioned the first three. Chuck Shakatoff, John Mullen, Steve Frank.
I'm going to have John. He has a meter that's about to expire and get a ticket, so he'll let him switch with John.
Oh, and Calhoun. I'm sorry. John Calhoun.
Please, good afternoon again.
We don't want you to add to the coffers of the city of Salem any more than is
necessary. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Unless you represent Salem, of course. Please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Reinhardt, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. Today I am representing the Equity Alliance of Oregon, a group of business leaders concerned that further avoidable budget cuts in response to our revenue shortfall will damage the state's economy, and that what the state should be doing is investing in education and business infrastructure. This morning's revenue forecast is relatively good news, and yet the fact that this is relief shows just how tragically low our expectations have become for the future of our state. We've seen funding for schools, universities, and critical infrastructure get slashed for years under a false assumption that there's just no other choice available to lawmakers. Too often, elected leaders throw up their hands and say there's nothing that can be done. Even the current budget framework is based on the assumption of many painful cuts to critical services. But whenever the legislature meets to set a budget, it always has a choice. It can increase revenues, cut spending, or do a combination of both. We're urging you not to fall in the trap of choosing only the cutting option, and I am here today to voice support of House Bill 4088 and other revenue-enhancing options. More budget cuts should not be our only response. As business leaders, we know that prosperity will result from proactive investments. We need to consider how to raise revenue and then invest it back in the very things that make this a great state. As business leaders, we believe that the worst thing the legislature could do right now for the business community is to reduce funding for education and other basic infrastructure. We need solutions that will jumpstart our economy, keep Oregon competitive, and start rebuilding the middle class. We need to invest in infrastructure. The revenue-raising provisions of HB 4088 are a good, reasonable point to begin the discussion. These components are designed to ask for more from the wealthy few while protecting middle-class families and small business. Have the budget cuts over the past year helped our economy? Not in our opinion. While we added 23,000 private sector jobs in the state over the last year, we cut 5,400 government jobs across the state, mostly in education. Laid-off teachers and firefighters no longer have money to spend at local businesses, causing destructive ripples through our entire state. Perhaps worse for our future prospects, cuts to our schools from K through 12 through the university system will leave students less prepared to compete in the modern economy. Corporations will hesitate to move here because of the lack of trained workforce and no real investment in business incubation. This is a recipe for economic disaster for our state as a whole and for individual families. Many will tell you that any increase in taxes on the wealthy or on business will hurt business. We disagree. First, everyone needs to realize that we are not a high-tax state. In 2011, a corporate-funded study found Oregon to have the nation's second-lowest effective business tax rate. With the possible exception of targeted tax subsidies, marginal tax rates have no role in location decisions made by business. As an investor, I have reviewed dozens and dozens of business plans and invested in more than a dozen. I have never seen a business plan that mentioned marginal tax rates as part of any investing decision. Yes, there are investments based upon targeted tax subsidies, but not what we all consider new business entities that will turn into the next Nike, Microsoft, or Intel. In fact, two of our biggest economic development competitors, Silicon Valley and Seattle, are locations with higher costs and higher business taxes. Companies move there from Oregon because they have the infrastructure we lack, not because they're seeking lower taxes. If we are to become competitive in recruiting and retaining high-growth companies, we must continue to invest and expand our infrastructure, not to cut our investments. Lastly, as business executives and upper-income individuals, we believe that the most equitable and effective tax system is one that is based on the ability to pay. We believe that Oregon's ongoing prosperity is tied directly to the strength of the middle class in providing real economic opportunities for all Oregonians, and that is why we support HB 4088.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Calhoun?
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Hopefully you've made the meter. And while the other two are talking, perhaps Steve Frank, if you could come
up. Well, it's 4087 that I've written down.
Yeah, and we'll hear you on 4087 after these other two gentlemen have spoken. Please, go ahead.
Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Chuck Shakatoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I'll try to be brief given the hour. I want to first applaud Representatives Buckley and Gelser for bringing these bills forward. You know, this issue actually is sort of is a textbook example of what I know a number of you who supported putting the sunsets on tax expenditures in 2009 have recognized that you used up some three-fifths capital, but you messed up in not including a number of non-tax credit tax expenditures. There were deductions and exemptions crying out for sunsets, and had you put a sunset on this back then and the sunset came up, you could change the programs clearly with a simple majority vote. And I just say that I actually am of the opinion that if you guys wrote a very clear legislative history into the bill that the spending has gone wild, and all the problems of it, and how it's inappropriate spending, and it violates the spending priorities that this legislature has, that this could be a spending bill and isn't the tax increase bill. It might bring in more revenue, but you're changing a spending program. And this is maybe I think Representative Gelser's bill would be a good vehicle to test that, because that's what this is. It's a misplaced spending through the tax code. I also point out that, you know, this has been debated for a long time. In 2003, it's been debated for quite some time. In 2004, Measure 30, actually one component of Measure 30 had a scale back of the senior medical deduction. And in the fall of 2003, Legislative Revenue Office put out a paper about the data. It was more lengthy than this one-page summary they have here. And we heard that AARP was having a big meeting to discuss whether to support the tax measure, and that the senior medical deduction was a red flag for them. And we took the LRO report, wrote a one-page paper, which is still on our website, and AARP supported the tax measure, which included a scale back for against upper-income people. It means-tested it, essentially. I'm confident that the senior groups would recognize that for most, especially even if you were just putting a income cap on it, most seniors would not be harmed by it at all, and that's why they would support it, because it's really only helping, you know, only 30% of taxpayers itemized today, so that's one of the things to remember when looking at it. It cries out for reform, and I hope you'll keep working at it, and maybe you'll get it as by putting sunsets on this and other tax credits, other tax expenditures, deductions and exemptions that need to be looked at again, or you'll do a test with legislative counsel about whether clear legislative findings that you're changing the spending that this committee does, and that historically this committee has done on saying that we're not going to spend this, that it's wrong that someone like me could have my taxes go down for my son's braces if I married someone who was over 62. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here is the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee. A couple of things, and I will be very brief as well. In 2011, Human Services Coalition worked with a number of groups to attempt to get a sign-on letter about how to change senior medical. We came very close to an agreement, and part of it, as Representative Gelser talked about, has to do with what we wanted to do about targeting some of the dollars, the savings. We're in a little bit of a different situation as we look at things this particular year. In the main, though, HISCO has really been interested to target this tax expenditure and to reduce the impact. I happen to be, I think, a poster child for this particular program in that my accountant last year said, remember that you're turning 62 next year and be ready to save all of your receipts. And I said, well, hopefully I'll have an opportunity to work on something where I'm either not eligible or the amount that I get back will be considerably less. I think to Representative Benz's point about it's not only the senior groups, but there needs to be a discussion, a broad discussion with the population out there so that they really understand this, understand the implications, and understand the effects on the budget, and understand how it affects them personally, because as has been talked about in the committee already today, those that don't itemize are not receiving a benefit from the current program. So in taking perhaps Representative Buckley at his word that nothing is going to go forward in this session, at least as far as his bills are concerned, Representative Gelser's bill, of course, is a little bit different. What I know the Human Services Coalition will do is commit to work with you if there is a discussion about how to change senior medical. This committee had to take on a very, very difficult issue with the property tax discussion, and in an understatement, it was not without controversy. But nevertheless, it was the committee taking on the responsibility of understanding that we had an insolvent program and an unsustainable future. Even though this program isn't isolated as a fund in and of itself, I think you really all understand the demographics and the potential damage to the budget in future years. So again, Human Services Coalition stands ready to work with you on a solution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Frank, you wanted to be heard on House Bill 4087.
Which I haven't heard talk about yet.
Right. Please
okay,
go ahead.
But that's fine.
Please go ahead.
I'm Steve Frank, and I just finished substituting today. Substitute taught kindergarten, first, second, third graders for music. And my wife is a home care worker. She cares for her mom, so her mom's a client. My darling granddaughter, who I've raised from birth, is in first grade. So I am, as far as this emergency fund, and as far as more or less what people are talking about here today, the care of our seniors, the jobs that the home care workers have and are providing services for the seniors are critical to the well-being of all of us. As Representative Ben said, he's getting close. He may need that one day. I'm getting close myself. So believe it or not, I just turned 59. The funding for these programs is critical, and obviously we're having all sorts of problems with trying to come up with ways to not cut these services and not cut education. So they're linked together, obviously, the House Bill 4088, 4087, and many other bills and issues you're dealing with. But what I want, hopefully, you'll remember and you'll keep in mind is these people are at risk, and whether they're at risk because of how much money they make in a year or how much they have economically, our children and our seniors and our disabled are the people we are charged with caring for. And I've been gone too long from this setting. It's been 4 years or so since I testified, and I'm really looking forward to getting back into it. You guys are great. Guys and gals are great, and I really appreciate all you do, and hearing the people testify who are testifying, it's tremendous. I'm invigorated as I get back into the mix. So thanks for all you do, and just remember, you know, that they're the ones that's why we're around, is to care for these people. All right. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger?
And only to say thank you. We don't hear "you guys are great" very often.
No, we don't.
Well, I may disagree on the issues. I may have issues with with that, but yes.
At 4:15, it sounded very nice. Thank you for coming down.
And I will say that this is the first time, except in an emergency, that this committee has met for more than 2 hours at a time, and we're scheduled on Wednesdays to meet for 4 hours every day, and I thought for sure we'd be finished long before this, but our discussions today have been very interesting, and I'm not sure I'd say they're invigorating, but they're certainly thought-provoking. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard yet today? Please come forward. Yes, and the man leaning against the wall is coming forward as well. Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Woolsey, Chair Barnhart and Chair Berger, and committee. I was born in 1947. All my life, I have not been able to use the rose-colored glasses. I've had boomer shoved in my face from early on. The elementary schools I went to were bursting at the seams because of all the children born my year and behind me. I got to high school, and I went to a brand-new high school after moving out of a school district where they had a brand-new high school. I worked at the Department of Revenue for 31 and a half years. I started out entry level. I worked for 15 years in the tax help section, giving advice to taxpayers, and then I went on to be an auditor. While we were in the tax help section, giving advice to people and helping them with fill their tax returns and that sort of thing, we quite often would tell them, if you can't itemize your deductions and you're an elderly person, you can itemize for Oregon purposes only. So there have been people who have been able to take the senior medical deduction who would not ordinarily have itemized for federal. This bill of Representative Gelser's makes it obvious. We would have to talk people into taking it. Now it will be obvious. I really love the fact that we're reducing the size of this program. Because if you don't find some way to put up some sideboards and caps and limits, my generation is going to burst it at the seams. And what's going to burst at the seams is the budget. If it hasn't already gone down in flames, we're going to take it down all the way. And that's all I have to say. Thank you
very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, Bill Olson, Co-Chair of the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I wanted to speak to Representative Bent's observation regarding the need to have consolidated support among the senior groups. Our position is probably a little easier than others in that we focus primarily on the vulnerable, low-income seniors and people with disabilities. I wish they were included in this. And I just want to say that we certainly support a reform of this program to target it more carefully toward lower income seniors. And we would work, of course, with the other groups to try to build support and cover for those of you who would be taking a vote on this bill, if and when it comes forth. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Frankly, I didn't even planned on saying anything today. I've testified last session, the session before that. I think if you look at that transcript, you'll see that I've been very consistent in the remarks I have made. From our perspective, taxation policy does matter, and it is a concern to us. And as currently structured, the senior medical deduction, as we commonly refer to it, is not good public policy. And we have also discussed a number of ways that we might make it slightly better public policy. We also recognize that it continues to eat up more and more of our tax dollars. And I've also said that ARP is certainly willing at any point in time to talk about how those limited dollars might be better spent, whether it makes sense to continue to spend them on this deduction or to spend them in direct services or some combination of those two. I think, frankly, if this was just about public policy, we'd have done this some time ago. So there must be some other issues involved. I've also had a number of conversations with many of you about how we might address some of those other issues. So in fact, perhaps some of your concerns might be addressed, and you might be able to better explain to your constituents the changes that might be made related to this deduction. We do also have a concern as if, in fact, there are dollars recaptured, how those dollars are spent. And I think I've been quite clear that ARP was not prepared to support any particular bill until we know both sides of that equation. What is the tax policy, and how the tax dollars that are recaptured might be spent? ARP continues to be ready to discuss this with you and support your efforts and provide you with information related, frankly, where our members are, because we have surveyed our members on this issue, and it is a difficult one for us as well as for you. But if you are prepared to go forward with some changes in this particular deduction, we are prepared to support you. Quite frankly, though, this session, I don't think there's an interest in going forward. If I'm wrong, please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? You've given us some food for thought. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today? Yes, I can see you snuck up on me. Please, go ahead.
I did. I will make this very, very brief. My name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. Our public policy committee has long discussed the senior medical deduction and needs for reform, and we would pledge helping to educate folk about what it really is, what the needs are, and try to use as much of our network as we can. And Representative Benz, we do have a few folk out in Eastern Oregon who might be able to help on that, because we do have branches in Pendleton. Enterprise.
If I might, it's not Eastern Oregon I'm worried about, because there's very few of us over there. I'm worried about Portland, Salem, and where all the folks are that vote. So, right over here. So I'm very happy you mentioned Eastern Oregon, but as you well know, much broader issue.
Yeah, and we do have branches all over the state, but, you know, we do have Eastern Oregon folk, and I do know that the Eastern Oregon folk do vote, too.
They do vote as well, yes.
And so that's basically all I say. I pledge to help work. Whatever you come out with, we will try to work with educating folk on it.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Representative Berger has a question for staff.
Chris or Paul, remind me of what our how it works. If you reduce an income stream, you can temporarily, for one biennium, decide this is how much. But how do you do going forward into, if you wanted to direct it to another program, how do you then determine your policy change over some other biennium and thereby say, oh, well, we did this, so 10 years from now that money is transferred over there? You understand the question, Paul? Mm-hmm.
I do. Madam Chair, the issue around the senior medical deduction is it's income taxes.
Right.
So, I mean, so it's a, it comes in that, in that pile of income taxes, and what you're doing by reducing the deduction is increasing net collections. But there are ways to do it in terms of estimating what it is. We've done it. Of course, we have the same issue around capital gains, that, you know, if there's a change in capital gains, you don't know, you know, how those dollars are lost. So you can, you can estimate what those are. Various efforts to try to create another fund or a special fund for those type of revenue sources. So the solution is to establish in the bill some type of an estimation process. And you could do that, you know, through the Department of Revenue, that they would make some estimation that would be based on some set criteria. And then those dollars could either be put in a separate fund, like the funds you have in the bill there, or just there could be some portion of the general fund that would be spent in that way, that, that in effect targets those dollars.
Yep, please.
But because we cannot, future legislatures have the authority to change that.
Madam Chair, they could certainly change the statute that would set that up, but you could set it up as another fund based on this estimate.
Okay.
And we've had some similar, I think you have a bill in the committee now that would do that with some local income tax revenue. That would income tax revenue and commit it to a separate fund for local governments. So that kind of thing could be done.
I think of this as the baseball bill.
No.
For those of you who are around, yes, for the baseball bill,
yes.
Representative Reed.
For
the soccer bill.
Madam Chair, the
soccer was sooner. It was baseball. Yeah.
The term is sequester.
Sequester. Yes. Thank you, Paul. I just wanted to get that discussion under.
Great. Appreciate it. Anything else on these three bills? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4087, 4088, and 4157. Colleagues, we have a meeting scheduled for Friday at 1 o'clock. We will consider a work session on the bill we discussed involving the property taxes and Indian governments. We'll also have a public hearing on a bill involving the Caucasus Mountain region of Western Asia. Thank you very much. And with that, committee, we are adjourned.